Show starts now.
Sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking about the filibuster reform that was founded. Oh, they came up with something. They agreed on something. Does it mean the end of gridlock? No. Does it mean that we're not going to see filibuster after filibuster? Probably not. Does it mean we may see some poison pills in almost every piece of legislation? Well, yeah, probably. Is it a step in the right direction? I don't know. I still think talking filibusters. Get your little behind up there. You want to block things up. You want to constipate the system. We need to know why. Also going to talk about the union density numbers. They're out in the right wing. The right wing nuts, they're in full tilt boogie, continuing their assault on workers and their rights here in Pennsylvania. The extremists, you know, people like Metcalf and Stephen Bloom, they've got their poison ready. We'll talk about that. And here's the thing. More importantly than the poison pill, because we know the right despises workers. They know we know that they despise anyone having some say, some ability to move into the middle class. You know, they're the folks who like to kick the ladder out from under you. But here's the thing. I mean, are we reliving the not-so-golden days of the past? Are we not reliving the days of the Lochner era, the good old days of the 1880s, 1890s? And are we not reliving a time when workers had no rights whatsoever? We're going to talk about that. Also, more proof that the calls for austerity are wrong-headed and dangerous. Some new numbers out. Going to talk about that. Also, the GOP hunt for the 2016 presidential nomination underway. Fundraising, election rigging. You can never start too soon, you know? You can never start too early on fixing the election, on getting that all done. And finally, bubblegum-flavored apples. 100% natural, evidently. Bubblegum-flavored apples. 100% natural whole apples. The flavor is on the inside. Yeah? And it comes in three. Apples now come in three very tasty, all natural flavors like bubblegum and pomegranate grape and tropical blast apples. What have we done? What are we doing in this country? But Rick, that's capitalism. That's the free market because kids want bubblegum apples. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Maybe you've had bubblegum apples. Would love to hear how they are. All natural, you know. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So this afternoon, my uncle calls me. Says, I got a good joke for you. Got a funny joke. You're going to love this. You go, how do you know the difference between a Romney voter and an Obama voter? And I go, I don't know. He goes, a Romney voter signs the paycheck on the front. And I said, yeah. He goes, yeah, one of my coworkers thought that was funny. Your coworkers? He goes, yeah. You mean the guy cashes the paycheck and signs it on the back thought that was funny? And sadly, yeah. And it really, you know, got me thinking that You listen to the rhetoric that's being shoved down our throat daily. And, you know, I think So I go back to my uncle. I said, well, what'd you say back? He goes, nothing. The guy's an idiot. Yeah, he's one of these guys who listens to this right-wing nonsense day in and day out. He's, you know, just saturated in the right-wing culture of talking points and, well, no rational thought. So, you know, there's no talking to him. And I said, well, you had to say something. You had to, you know, the irony of that you voted for a guy that you just said. No, and it was none of that, because sadly we've allowed in this country that kind of polarization. And, you know, I started talking to, you know, I go, you know, I think back to my grandparents' generation, to where if, you know, if something like that were to have been said then, I think it would have been met with a fairly swift response. And I look at this and I go, you know, we need to be having those conversations, and we need to stop that stuff when it's said. Because what it does is it does what Jay Gould said. You know, not as vicious, not as permanent, but you know, the idea that we can split people up. We can keep people at each other's throats. We can keep people pointing their fingers at each other and screaming past each other and not listening and not thinking and not saying, how do we all move forward? And you go back to the Jay Gould quote, I can easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. And you know, I see these moments where, did the guy really think about what he was saying? Because if it was my uncle's boss who said, well, you know, I could understand that. Because that's the divide. That's the divide that's always been. But what they've been able to do is divide the workers and keep us pointing fingers and shouting and telling dumb jokes as if they're funny. And I see nothing funny in it. I could make the argument that it's probably fairly true. But you look at the last 4 years and you go, well, maybe that's not entirely true, because this president has, well, under his leadership, under his direction, good, bad, whatever your thoughts on it are, Wall Street's never done better. I think I saw something today. It was the S&P hit the number it hasn't hit since 2007. Corporate profits, never higher. CEOs, fat and happy. Shareholders going, hoo-hoo! And the other part of that, to take it back to my uncle and his coworker, wages have never been lower. So that thing that you're signing your name on the back of, and the Romney voter is evidently, according to the ha-ha funny joke, signing on the front, never lower. So does that make a lot of sense? And the answer is no. But here again, we've allowed ourselves to be polarized and divided. We've allowed ourselves to be distracted. It's the shiny thing. It's our team. So when they throw something out, like the union density numbers that came out yesterday, say people are choosing not to. Not that the laws are so screwed up. Not that it's, you know, for anyone who's gone through organizing campaigns, not that it's extremely difficult and extremely, well, intimidating. What you've got is you've now got the power of the person who, I signed the check on the front, telling you, well, you know, I may close the place, or I may fire people, or a whole plethora of threats and intimidation that come out. And you go, wow, you wonder why. Especially in an economy that's been faltering. And you can take that to everything that we do. Education, healthcare, all of this stuff. When you have the very top telling the very bottom, you're not getting it. And then they use us against themselves. I saw this Craigslist ad that caught my attention. For $20 for an hour, I guess it was $20 to come to this rally and stand. The Facebook ad read, our firm needs 100 volunteers to attend and participate in a rally in front of the British Consulate Embassy in Midtown Manhattan. Gotta pay 20. The event is being held in order to protest wind turbines that are being built in Scotland and England. So we're going to come to the U.S. We're going to get a bunch of people who we'll pay $20 to stand and pretend like you're protesting because why? Well, an act of division. An act of, hey, there are people who are against this. Not that we're paying, not that it's that we're paying them. And, you know, we saw the same thing, if you remember, when the EPA was having a hearing. And the coal interests were paying people $50 to wear their pro-coal T-shirts. Same kind of thing. But here again, it's all about keeping us divided. It's all about keeping us against each other. And I look at this thing yesterday with Matt Metcalf and Stephen Bloom and the rest of the radical right. This open workforce initiative. That sounds great, doesn't it? The open workforce initiative. Who could be against open work? Who could be against an initiative? Sounds like you're actually doing something. The only thing they're doing is making that paycheck worth less. They're making the conditions at which you earn that paycheck more dangerous. Nothing good here. And what amazes me is that we as the electorate, you and me, we don't hold these people accountable because they still haven't passed the jobs bill. There's no infrastructure bill. The transportation, not happening. It's all division. It's all divisiveness. It's all destructive. And at some point, you know, I've been saying we got to take to the streets and we got to hold them accountable. We're going to take a quick break. I'm going to come back, talk about this, the Open Workforce Initiative. Oh, that sounds wonderful. Cannot wait. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Amalgamated Transit Union says the public isn't getting accurate information from New York City's mayor about the impact of the school bus strike. The week-old strike was triggered when the city tried to strip job protections from the contract. ATU says the mayor is refusing to negotiate with the union. The New York State AFL-CIO and the New York City Central Labor Council are both supporting the strike. The union says city council members have supported the striking workers, and the workers are also meeting with parents' groups who support them. The union says it's making sure that parents have accurate information about the strike, and the ATU says it's winning the ground game. ATU says the mayor's claim that it's illegal to put employee protection provisions in the new contract is false. ATU says no court has ruled that those protections are illegal. The union also says the mayor is wrong when he says he can't negotiate with the union. ATU says there is a 34-year record of the city negotiating employee protection provisions with the union. The mayor wants to strip workers of job protections by bidding out school bus contracts to private companies that could then fire workers, lower wages, or strip away benefits. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the overall percentage of American workers in unions dropped to just 11.3% in 2012. That's down from 11.8% in 2011. Unions lost 400,000 members in 2012. All told, there are 14,366,000 union workers in the U.S. Unions represent just 6.6% of all private sector workers in the U.S. The Laborers International Union of North America is urging swifter action on implementing new rules to protect workers from silica exposure. Jesse Russell reports.
For nearly 100 years, workers have been suffering from silica exposure on the job. During that time, there has been a great deal of discussion about the lung disease and cancer that can result from the exposure, but little has been done. In 1997, OSHA began drafting new rules, which weren't sent to the White House's Office of Management and Budget until February of 2011. To date, those rules have yet to be released to the public for review. And once they are made public, it could take years of lengthy public hearings before they're made official. Every year, an estimated 280 workers succumb to silica-related illnesses. The Laborers International Union of North America has published a petition on the White House We the People website, hoping to generate 25,000 signatures necessary to trigger a response from the president. In a statement, the union said that while the government continues to delay on taking action, thousands of workers are being exposed to silica, guaranteeing more deaths and illness.
This newscast is made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW and from the OPEIU. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If this was done under Rendell's administration, the GOP would be jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin. I just want to make that point. I mean, the Republicans would be going nuts.
You're right. Had Rendell tried to privatize in this manner, like thieves in the night, on a Friday at 4:45, while everybody's out of town, they would have. You're right. They'd have lost their minds, and the media in this state would have been doing backflips. And I got to give them credit. This lottery privatization thing, folks, not all too happy with. I've seen some negative. Not enough, in my opinion, but some. Anyway, our quote of the day comes from State Representative Daryl Metcalf when he introduced his quote-unquote open workforce initiative. He said whether the economic objective is reining in astronomical state employee pension costs, liquor privatization, or expanding school choice, evidence across the nation proves the most critical and essential step for economic growth is to break the government-sanctioned grip of compulsory unions by making Pennsylvania a right-to-work state. So what he's saying, and look, you know, you're talking about 6.6% of the workforce with all of this power. But what he's saying is, and it's pretty simple, in order for us to steal those workers' pensions, privatize all of taxpayers' assets, and completely screw up public education, we've got to take people's rights away. Pretty simple. At least that's the way I read it. That's why I've asked our friend Pennsylvania State Representative Scott Conklin to come talk to us about the Open Workforce Initiative and also Mad Cow's statement. Scott, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, as always, when you call in, you see, Rick, what you have to understand, what your listeners have to understand, you haven't learned corporate math.
Okay.
You've got to understand corporate math, and here's how corporate math works. If the lottery system has, over the last 10 years, including the two town years, has had a 6.21 return. That means over the next 20 years, the lottery system's going to make $46 billion. But what we do is we give it to a foreign country that'll give us $34 billion back, and they'll increase more games so they make even more revenue. That's called corporate math. That's where the corporation gets to make money and the people make less. The same with the state stores, the same with the state employees, the same with the prison system. I mean, it's become very clear over the last month that what myself and others thought was a group of individuals bungling along, trying to get something done, the master plans finally come together. And if you really want me to give you the great conspiracy theory tonight, I can lay it out for you step by step.
Oh, I absolutely want the conspiracy theory. I want to know what's coming so that folks know, hey, when it hits, you heard it here first.
Well, let's start with the lottery system. Camelot, nothing against Camelot, just gave their executives tens of hundreds of millions of dollars in raises. They're going to double the cost of playing the lottery where they're overseeing it, and they specialize in keno and online gambling. So all that is going to be coming to Pennsylvania, which, by the way, now we're finding out that a Rhode Island company who would like to have bid on this wasn't allowed to. And we did this before the Attorney General came in. But to go back to what I started with, if you use historical data, which I realize that this doesn't always work out to some folks' the corporate math, what they want to do. What the governor's telling you is that we're going to give this to a corporation that is less efficient than what state employees are. Yep. What he's telling you is that we're going to get rid of 70%. In fact, the governor, what he's telling you is that when he took office, the unemployment rate was well below the national average. But with his wonderful jobs plan, we're now above the national average. But to go back to start with the lottery system, 6.21% average over 10 years. You take that same exact percentage with historical basis on it, you take that to the next 20 years, the state lottery system for our senior citizens will have a $46 billion increase. What we're going to do is give it to a foreign country who's, by the way, going to be housed in Maryland where they don't pay taxes, will give us $34 billion. So off the top, we're losing $12 billion. You've seen recently that he's closed some prisons in Pennsylvania, right, which, by the way, are union employees. Now, if I was a real conspiracy man, I would say that what he wanted to do was to get rid of the union employees, which, by the way, over the last 2 years, when you look at the prison inmates, he's been overcrowding them in other prisons to bring the numbers down at the ones he closed. What he's doing next is he's going to privatize the maintenance force on those. So for the next year or two, those prisons are going to sit empty, but we're going to privatize it out. Rather than having the state union employees work there, we're going to get rid of those. We're going to bring in a private firm, which is going to cost about $5 million a year for each one of those. After we close them for a year, we're going to say, you know what? This is costing us too much money. Let's bring in private prison vendors, and we'll pay them to oversee the prison. The third thing that if you're looking at on the state's words, he's going to come up with a new plan. The last plan, even the beer distributors he wanted to give it to, fell through. They're going to come up with a new plan, which we're still trying to figure out which way they're going to go. But again, this is about, and we've talked about this before, the only place that a working man such as myself can get the revenue that I need to run a campaign is that those women that work at the nursing home, those state troopers, those linemen that go out and turn the power on Hurricane Sandy, every week they take 60 cents out of their check, a dollar out of their check, they put it in a pack, and they give to me. And I'll tell you what, that's who I want to take my money from. I want to take it from the guy who puts a buck in. Well, the only way you can stop that dollar from coming out is to stop the union.
Yep.
And that, the plan has become very clear. But what really shocks me is that the stats that you look at is the union participation has gone down. So has the median income of the households gone down as well. And again, we talked about this before. I never thought I'd see a day to where people on the street have representatives such as Daryl who are telling them, I want you to make less money. I want you not to have hospitalization. I want you not to have benefits. I want you not to have a retirement plan. And people follow them. I never thought I'd see the day that people will actually follow somebody who's telling them, I want you to have less, I want you to have nothing later on in life. Never have I seen anything like this.
I mean, it absolutely blows my mind. And, you know, and I guess what it is it's been 30 years of indoctrination. Oh, those evil unions. They've been able to divorce workers from the idea that they're members of that union, just as folks have just as they've done with their government. You know, it's always the government or it's the union. It's not our government or our union. It's always this, like it's some outside entity.
And what most people don't understand, you know, on the surface, it sounds like, you know what, if you don't want to belong to a union, you shouldn't have to belong to one. What they forget to bring up, which you know about, and I think we have to bring it up more, federal law mandates that if you're in a union shop, even if you don't want to pay union dues, you still have to be protected by the union contract itself.
Yep.
You still have to be protected by the union arbitration, even if you don't want to pay dues. So basically what they're saying is you get to ride the bus for free.
Yeah, absolutely. And you look at the place where someone had sent me a couple of years ago where I think it was one of the labor groups in Kentucky had sent a request to the Chamber of Commerce to be a member, but they didn't want to pay dues. And the Chamber of Commerce said, well, in order to be a member, in order to get our benefits, you've got to pay dues. And the guy wrote back, well, yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, almost like a union. I mean, one of the most interesting things, as you saw, the governor was going to unveil his plan this week of the corporate stocks and franchise fee, which, by the way, comes about 31 cents a gallon extra on gas. I mean, we can't bring that up because, as I was told by one of the senators, that they aren't raising fee. All of this is an enabler that if the gas company so wishes to pass that 31 cent a gallon tax on to you all, they can't. And I'm sure no gas company will ever pass on that 31 cent a gallon.
Oh, of course
gas
not. Tax. No, never.
But at the same time, I said, well, do you think we can collect a severance fee that the gas companies are already taking because they have to incorporate the price, or maybe close the loopholes to get the $3.6 billion we need? That's off the table. But the interesting thing is that the governor, as you know, was supposed to unveil his funding mechanism today or yesterday. But evidently his members came to him and told him that there is no way they're voting for a 31 cent a gallon gas tax on working people.
So nothing out.
Nothing out. Nothing. We have made it firmly clear that we're not going to follow, for years we always had to follow the Texas model. Everyone always says, let's follow the Texas model. So we finally had the Texas model at our hands to where we could do just like Texas did, use our natural resources, that of the people of Pennsylvania, and actually use those to benefit without people having their property taxes raised, without them having their gas taxes raised, without government dipping into their pocket, and actually begin to do some repairs just like Texas does. But now we don't want to be like Texas anymore. For myself, if you can't tell, it's getting frustrating. I mean, as a guy, I can go on all night long with you. As a guy who represents Penn State, to have a man, vote to fire Joe Paterno, have a man vote to take the NCAA sanctions, does a press conference on July the 23rd, who says that these sanctions, the $60 million penalty is great, these sanctions are great, let's accept them, and then turn around here a couple weeks ago and says, you know what, this is devastating, we can't do this. To have a man that, runs for office that says that he's going to protect people and protect their rights, to find out that he's actually done the opposite. I think we ran in this with Mitt Romney. It's a matter of trust. And yep. I believe that what they're doing now is absolutely against the people's trust.
I'm right with you, Scott. And I worry that the next 6 months, because, for all of what you've pointed out, you're basically helpless to stop anything that they want to do. I mean, if they want to privatize the wine and spirit shop, it's done. They want to sign off on the lottery. They've got the steamroller numbers.
They are going to put so many Pennsylvanians out of work, and they don't care. They don't care. You're right. If this would have been Ed Randall or Bob Casey or any Democrat who said, I want a foreign country to come into Pennsylvania, who, by the way, are going to be housed in Delaware so they don't have to pay any Pennsylvania taxes, and we're going to give them one of our most lucrative and productive things that help our senior citizens, they would have been thrown out of office. But the problem is they come in and they promise $34 billion, and it's a lot of money. Again, the bottom line is...
But let me ask you about that, then.
$12 billion. It's going to cost us $12 billion. We would make $46 billion. But on top of that, they're going to add online gambling, which means kids can get online and do it. They're going to add more Keno, and I haven't heard one mention about helping people with addiction. I mean, I'm on every phase, they're pushing gambling, which my friends on the right are against. They're pushing addictions, which my friends on the right are against. But still, they're staying quiet, and they're allowing the governor to do this.
And why is that? I mean, is it the money? Is it, as you pointed out, that you got to have the money to get elected?
We were outspent so badly the last time. The amount of money today from the gas companies and from these organizations is astronomical. As the gentleman said, it's only a matter of time till they take anybody out at any time. And I expect them to start seeing members who are standing up against them be primaried in their own primary on the Democratic side. I wouldn't be surprised to see that in the next 6 to 8 years, just so they can run both sides. Because as you well watched, certain votes that should have never have had certain members voting on because of political affiliation, yeah, they're now voting that way. And again, it's because of the money. Because they know to be able to be effective, to be able to stay there, it's the only place to be able to get the revenues you need to run effective campaigns.
So what do we do? I mean, you know, I've met a number of people who, you know, what's frustrating to me on so many levels is we get these talking points, we get these, you know, these sound bites, and you know, people just regurgitate them ad nauseum without actually thinking them through. How do we break through it? Because we've become a culture where politics is about team sport.
Well, if you've followed me at all for the last few months, as you can tell, I've finally had enough. I'm finally no longer, you know, doing the sound bites and yelling. I'm going in, as they say, into the fire itself. And myself, and I believe some of my colleagues, are just going to go in. And we're going to take them on head on in the streets in an open forum. I mean, everything they're doing right now, myself, I'm very vocal about it. I'm going out. There's other legislators that are vocal about it. The only way we're going to be able to fight these gentlemen is to be able to take them head on. And to be able to, and it's time we start calling names. When the folks do it, whoever they may be, who's trying to control, who's trying to run, who's trying to do this, we not only call out the politician that's doing it, but we call out their backers as well. Just put them in the shine light, because it's the old adage. Everybody loves to throw their grenade in the room, but they don't want to be in the room when it goes off. It's time we pull them in.
And
they can be there.
And as one of our guests last night said, you know, with Daryl Metcalf's, set of bills that are solely, as you pointed out, the sole purpose of them is to have people earn less money.
Except Daryl, of course.
Of course.
I've never remembered Daryl. Daryl is, as you well know, an unusual individual. My favorite Daryl Metcalf story is about a year and a half ago. He wanted to come up because I still want a constitutional convention. I think the people have a right to change things, you know, redistricting, financing campaigns. All this needs to be put on the table for the people to get involved in it. Daryl is 100% a constitutional convention to change anything because the Constitution's perfect, but he had three bills in at the time to change the Constitution. What he's saying is, I don't want the people changing the rules. I want to change rules, just like Pelleggi.
Yeah.
You know, there were 5 billion more people voted for Barack Obama than Mitt Romney. But if they used the Pelleggi plan to where we used electoral votes, Mitt Romney would be president of the United States today. He would have won the electoral college using the Pelleggi plan to take away the popular vote of the state and giving it to the gerrymandered congressional seat.
Now, I think you give Pelleggi too much credit, because I don't really think that was his plan. I think that's one of those Alec type things that, because we're seeing it popping up in other states as well.
Oh, it is. It's popping up. The same plan. It's much like the voter ID bill. You're seeing it pop up in the northeastern states, Michigan, you know, Ohio, Pennsylvania. It's the same plan across the board. And before anybody gets me wrong, you're going to be shocked on this one. I respect Senator Pelleggi. I really do. I don't have an axe to burn with him, but the only reason I used his name is that plan that he's pushing, if it would pass, it would have given Mitt Romney the presidential election. Even though 5 million more people voted for Barack Obama, under that plan, Mitt Romney would be president today.
And that's the goal. I mean,
that's absolutely the goal.
Already talking about that. So what do we do? I mean, you know, in looking at this, you look at all of the attacks, you look at all of this legislation, you look at the power that they have, and we know the next 6 months are just going to be hell for working people in this state, as they basically give away all of our assets and destroy conditions for workers here. What do we do?
It's time that we find our friends. There are friends on the other side of the aisle, which you well know that. We have to get into those folks, but we have to go out. And we have to be precise with our statements, and we have to make it simple for people to understand. and we have one nice thing about this governor. He's one of the least popular governors in the history of Pennsylvania at this point. And I think it's because he has changed course and he has shown that he's willing to say what it takes to get to the next level.
Right.
Again, I'm only using the Penn State issue because when I'm there, when a man votes to do something, when a man encourages you to take it, when a man says this is the way it has to be, then all at once he realizes that the public's against it. He still isn't against it. He never says against it himself. He realizes the public's against it. He turns a 180. I think it's time for us to get out and really push it. Push the fact that under, you know, this foreign country, we don't get $46 billion. We get $34 billion. The fact that people are, you know, Pennsylvanians are losing jobs under this privatization. There's not one thing he's doing that's creating jobs for Pennsylvanians. There's nothing he's doing that's creating a good pay for Pennsylvanians. All what he's doing, as I like to call it now, is his corporate math. Only his corporate math can you say, we're going to have private company take it over and make less than what we do it ourselves. And I explained it to a businessman today. I stopped in his store. And he asked me why government shouldn't be involved in anything. Government shouldn't control anything. We should get rid of everything. While I'm standing there, he has one of his staff is mopping the floor. And I looked at him. I said, why don't you get a private contractor to mop your floor? And the man says, I can't afford it. It costs me a fortune. I said, so basically, what you're telling me in business, sometimes it's cheaper to have your own people do it than it is to contract it out for somebody else. He says, absolutely. I said, that's exactly how the lottery system works, and that's exactly how the state system works. It's cheaper for us as Pennsylvanians to have our own people do it than it is to have an outside entity do it.
Yeah,
and he got it. He understood it.
But the other part of that is there are some things that you do that inherently there's no profit in. You're doing it for the good of society, like making sure that we don't expand gambling into every corner of our commonwealth. I mean, putting it into the grade schools and putting it into the high schools and then every laptop and PC in this state. I don't know that that's a good thing for our society.
And by the way, Rick, a little over a year ago, they tried to pass Keno in Pennsylvania by the people's representative. As much as we want to get mad at ourselves over trying to do things, but over the last year, it's worked out well. We've stopped the sale of the state store. The people's representative in a Republican-controlled era, the people's representative, the elected official, the state representative, voted for what the people wanted. They wanted no more gambling in Pennsylvania. They didn't want Keno. They didn't want online gambling, the majority of them. We voted it down. So the governor is going against the people's will, going against the elected body's will, and bringing in a foreign country to not only take it over, but add more gambling. And the numbers I'm giving you, the $46 billion versus $34 billion, that doesn't even take into account Keno and online gambling. That doesn't even take that out. That's just more profit for Camelot to make.
And the thing that I keep asking people is, what happens if no one buys a ticket next year? What happens? Let's say a billion. Nobody buys anything. Is Camelot going to hand us $1 billion?
My understanding is that there's a fallout out agreement that Camelot isn't held responsible.
So then the certainty that the governor is telling us is there isn't really there.
That's what my understanding is. By the way, no one gets to see the contract, including the Rhode Island company who wanted to bid on it and wasn't given the information. I mean, not that I would have wanted the Rhode Island company any more than I want Camelot, but at least they would have been an American company. And my understanding is that the governor's people went over to England and met with Camelot prior to the request for information to go out. The bid came out.
Wow. There doesn't seem to be any backroom dealing there. Let me ask you.
No.
Last question I've got for you, the big State of the State speech coming up. What do you think? What do you see in that? I mean, I see a lot of the privatization, but I see him going full after the pension fund.
He's gone after it all. Let's face it. The money in Pennsylvania is just like Social Security nationally. Our pension system has a lot of money for someone to get a hold of it. And by the way, Act 120, if you left it play out, in the next 8 to 10 years, we'll reinvest. What these politicians, and here's what I really love. The same people who made this mess with their vote in 2001 to raise it to 3%, 2.5% and 3%. Their same vote in 2002 and 2003 to lower the employer share of it. Their same vote to spend it off. These are the same people now who are saying, you know what, it's screwed up. You got to get rid of it. We have to get out. But Act 120 that we passed in 2010, if the governor would look at those numbers, he would see that it's going to correct itself because of the measures we already did to it. And if the governor understood anything about pension systems, you got to understand you can't change over to a 401k, and you can't have two separate systems, because if we take the people who are paying into it today out of the system, that will bankrupt the system immediately.
But isn't that the point?
But you let a lot of retirees on the hook. Again, I'm going back to his corporate math. Because it doesn't add up. The numbers don't add up. And, you know, he won't answer questions at a press conference. I would love to debate the man. I would love to get him on the stage in an open forum myself, because nothing he's doing is adding up, except he wants to give away. And as long as I'm rattling, as you saw now, he had his education people redo the numbers for charter schools. Now we're finding out charter schools weren't 54% efficient. They're only in the 20% as passing efficient grades. So everything he's done is smoke and mirrors, and there's something behind it that has nothing to do with what, or has nothing to help the people. It's strictly coming up with a way to give more Pennsylvania assets away.
Yeah, and he's doing an excellent job of that, and I'm hoping you will have the chance to debate him at some point. He may be running for re-election, so there's an opportunity and maybe a hint.
We're looking at it, but the man. Absolutely. It's my Irish heritage, Rick. You know that. He has me fired up. And as you know, as the Irishman, you know, we have a long memory when somebody hurts our family. And the working people of Pennsylvania are my family. I still carry union cards in 77. These are my brothers and sisters. And anybody that knows anything about folks with our background, when you mess with the family, you mess with every one of us.
That's what I love about you, Scott. I appreciate the time. It's always great talking to you.
Hey, thanks, Rick. You have a great night.
You too. Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Perhaps you thought that surely the far right wing in American politics couldn't get any nuttier. If so, you clearly hadn't factored in Glenn Beck. Since losing his glory spot as a Fox TV yakety yakker, Beck has been less visible, but no less busy, continuing to promote himself as leader of the political wacky and still delighting them as the P.T. Barnum of conspiracy theories. His hottest-selling shtick in recent months is a piece of fear-mongering about an entity that few other people in the world consider at all fearsome, the United Nations. Agenda 21, wails the Beckster on his subscription TV show and other forums, referring to an obscure, innocuous, and non-binding resolution approved by UN members, including the U.S., 21 years ago. Be very afraid, Beck bleats in alarm, for this document lays out the secret diabolical scheme of internationalists to seize America's autonomy. Under the guise of promoting sustainable development, goes the theory, the United Nations intends to ban our suburbs, take our golf courses from us, usurp our freedoms, and impose a global dictatorship. To depict the horror of Agenda 21, the cover of Beck's new book on the topic features the UN logo looming over an American landscape which is imprisoned behind barbed wire. Subtle. Silly, too. But it's the hot new thing on the far right. Heroic lawmakers in Alabama and Tennessee have already banned any implementation of Agenda 21-style provisions in their states, even though none were proposed. Five other state legislatures are considering the same this year. And the big rumor on the right is that Barack Obama is using CIA mind control techniques to implement the UN dictatorship. This is Jim Hightower saying, do these people ever even visit reality? Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, he's right. I mean, you're going to see a lot of this insanity coming up here. And just, you know, just like we saw in Wisconsin, just like you saw in Indiana, if you don't think right-to-work nonsense can happen here, I fear people are seriously underestimating the power of big money. And, you know, when the numbers come out, 6.6% of the workforce in unions, and you see this kind of political push, you know it's purely ideological. Because I'm sorry, I'm not buying this whole, oh, well, you know, the only way we could possibly do these things is, well, to take these rights away from people. And I know I've been talking about this quote for a while, but to me, it really highlights exactly what the right wing thinks. When Metcalf says the only way we're going to be able to steal pensions and privatize state assets and destroy education is getting rid of those unions. He's being honest. The only way that you're going to, and the same thing with the pension fund, you know, it's divide and conquer. As long as you can keep people separated, as long as you can keep things split up, what do you think you got? You got the chance. And, you know, this whole thing with the pension fund, it just blows my mind that anyone is even considering when we've seen how bad it has been in other places. But here again, you know, we've bought into some nonsense. This whole talk of austerity, we've bought into it. And the other day we had talked about this golfer, Phil Mickelson, who evidently made the dumb statement of, you know, saying, well, I'm going to have to leave because I'm going to have to pay higher taxes. You know, I'm going to have to move to another state. I'm going to leave California. Well, you know, he says, oops, I'm sorry I got caught, is really what he said. He said, I've made some dumb mistakes, and obviously talking about this stuff was one of them. I made a big mistake talking about this stuff publicly, and I should have done that. Yeah, I mean, as my old man always said, if you're gonna do something, be the only one who knows you're doing it. Because then you got about a 50% chance of getting ratted out. Well, he ratted himself out. Here's a guy who, somewhere around $73 million he's taken in as a golfer. And, you know, you go and you look at this and you say, you know, times are tough. Budgets are being cut. Education's being slashed. Just look here in Pennsylvania, for instance. You know, $2 billion from public education. Look, it's going to happen some more. They completely do away with the general assistance budget, which is to help the poorest of the poor, the most vulnerable of the most vulnerable. People on their last string. I mean, this is the end of the road. Booted 41,000 people off of adult basic, a very minimal insurance plan for low-wage worker, 88,000 kids off of Medicaid. The list goes on. but we hand out huge money to corporations and, oh, we can't raise taxes. So when I see Mickelson say something, well, it was a dumb thing for me to say. No, it was what you were thinking. It's like when Romney talked about, no, those 47%. He wasn't inarticulate. He didn't stutter. He didn't stammer. The words flowed right off of his tongue. It's what you were thinking. It's what you believe. Same thing with Mickelson. And what blows my mind is, you know, a lot of us have bought into these really very wealthy people crying the blues. I mean, I saw something the other day. The Walton family, the six sperm lottery winners, they hold almost $108 billion in net worth. And I adjust that for inflation. Just go back to 1982 when Forbes 400 did their first wealth list. Just those six people. When you adjust for inflation, so you bring those 1982 dollars up to 2012, what do you have? These six people have as much wealth as half of the entire wealth of the Forbes 400. So at the time in 1982, the wealthiest of the wealthy, those top 400, the heavy 400, these six people have more accumulated wealth than half of them. And the reason I bring that up is what we have seen is the consolidation of wealth into the hands of fewer and fewer and fewer people. And where does it come from? Well, it comes from you and me. We've created this. We've created the wealth class through lower wages, through lower benefits, through social programs that subsidize low-wage employers and destroy higher-wage employers. And, you know, I go back and I think about my grandmother, who worked in a small department store where they were making decent money. They could raise a family. They had health care. They had pensions. They had sick days. They had vacations. They had all of that stuff. And in come the Walmarts of the world. And with their race to the bottom, low-wage mentality, they tore everyone down. How do you turn that around? Well, I'm saying it's education. It's going, you know what? We need to be talking about this stuff. We need to be talking about the direction of the country and what road we should be taking. Should we be taking the low road? Where, hey, you know, hooray, let's slit each other's throats for pennies until we get down to where we'll work for food won't be enough. We'll work for food won't be a low enough wage for people to hire you. Because that's what the right is bringing us. Desperation Nation. You're on your own, brother. Get out there and fight it out. And they couch it in nice terms. Oh, it's competition, Rick. Don't you know? Are you afraid of a good, spirited competition? No, I'm not. When the rules are even and the playing field is level. Understand, it's not. The game is rigged because the referee, well, on the payroll. You look at our legislation that comes out. You look at this idiotic initiative that Metcalf and the others, the Stephen Blooms of the world and the Jerry Knowles of the world keep throwing out there. Why? Because it's funded. They got huge money. So you look at this story I saw from the AP. Austerity fails. Of course it fails. We know it was going to. But according to the report, and they looked at data released on Wednesday, the country's totaled, it just blows my mind that we even have to talk about this as if it's not something we don't already know. They write, the country's total government debt related to their annual economic output was barely changed at 90% of gross domestic product in the third quarter of 2012, compared with 89.9% for 3 months earlier. The EU Statistics Office, Eurostat, reported this on Wednesday. It was up from 86.8% of GDP a year later. So, you're looking at the debt numbers, you're looking at what's going on, and what ends up happening. They're deeper and deeper in debt. They've triple dip recessed, but they're still going deeper into debt. And, you know, you look at this and you go, at some point, when do we get it? Unemployment is at a record high in the Eurozone. The IMF and the ILO have said that, you know, any more of this fiscal consolidation is going to kill economic growth even further. You're seeing all of these different things saying, look, had you not followed the austerity, had you not followed the path that the EU took, which is cut, gut, and punish, the debt loads would have been lower, not higher. And these are lessons for us to learn here at home. I mean, it's stuff that we need to see the reality in this. If we're cutting social programs, if we're cutting education, if we're cutting investment in our workforces, if we're cutting investment in higher ed and roads and bridges and in infrastructure and all the things that we need, what's it going to do down the road? What kind of deficits will we be leading then? As we cut wages for workers on all plans, how is that good for, if you're one of the debt bucks, if you're one of the, oh, we got to do something about the deficit, how is it that a spiraling down economy of diminished wages and diminished expectations, how is that good for any of the ills that we have? I'll tell you how we get out of this, and I've been saying this for the long, get people back to work. Invest heavily in education. Invest heavily in healthcare. Invest heavily in roads and bridges and 21st century infrastructure. We don't want to be the Flintstones anymore. You know, when we're, what, 15th, 18th in the world, broadband access, there's something wrong there. And what it is we've created too much of the wealth class. And I go back to these six wealthy heirs, who the hardest day of work they probably did was coming through the birth canal, holding more wealth, just the six of them, than half of the Forbes 400 list from 1982, and you look at that consolidation of wealth into the hands of few. How is that good for our democracy? How is that good for our economy? How is it good for our nation? Truth of the matter is it's not. And what it's done is put us in a position where we're pitted against one another. So that when Daryl Metcalf and Stephen Bloom and the rest of the extremists in the Republican Party say, oh, the only way we're going to steal those public sector pensions and the only way we're going to privatize state assets and destroy education is by taking those union rights away. That should be a red flag. That should be that moment where you go, wait a second. Maybe he's got a point there. Maybe that's why we need stronger labor unions, which is why maybe I would want to be a member. Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you can go to get the podcast. Also, the Stitcher app is there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. You can also email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And again, I look at this, you know, there has got to be something. We've got to get in the streets. We've got to get calling our representatives. We'll take a quick break right back after this with Hour 2. Stick around.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Amalgamated Transit Union says the public isn't getting accurate information from New York City's mayor about the impact of the school bus strike. The week-old strike was triggered when the city tried to strip job protections from the contract. ATU says the mayor is refusing to negotiate with the union.
The New York State AFL-CIO and the New York City Central Labor Council are both supporting the strike. The union says city council members have supported the striking workers, and the workers are also meeting with parents' groups who support them. The union says it's making sure that parents have accurate information about the strike, and the ATU says it's winning the ground game. ATU says the mayor's claim that it's illegal to put employee protection provisions in the new contract is false. ATU says no court has ruled that those protections are illegal. The union also says the mayor is wrong when he says he can't negotiate with the union. ATU says there is a 34-year record of the city negotiating employee protection provisions with the union. The mayor wants to strip workers of job protections by bidding out school bus contracts to private companies that could then fire workers, lower wages, or strip away benefits. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the overall percentage of American workers in unions dropped to just 11.3% in 2012. That's down from 11.8% in 2011. Unions lost 400,000 members in 2012. All told, there are 14,366,000 union workers in the U.S. Unions represent just 6.6% of all private sector workers in the U.S. The Laborers International Union of North America is urging swifter action on implementing new rules to protect workers from silica exposure. Jesse Russell reports.
For nearly 100 years, workers have been suffering from silica exposure on the job. During that time, there has been a great deal of discussion about the lung disease and cancer that can result from the exposure, but little has been done. In 1997, OSHA began drafting new rules, which weren't sent to the White House's Office of Management and Budget until February of 2011. To date, those rules have yet to be released to the public for review. And once they are made public, it could take years of lengthy public hearings before they're made official. Every year, an estimated 280 workers succumb to silica-related illnesses. The Laborers International Union of North America has published a petition on the White House We the People website, hoping to generate 25,000 signatures necessary to trigger a response from the president. In a statement, the union said that while the government continues to delay on taking action, thousands of workers are being exposed to silica, guaranteeing more deaths and illness.
This newscast is made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW and from the OPEIU. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
Isn't that what they're telling corporate America? Free money, just come and we'll hand it out to you. And you wonder why this report put out by the Grapevine Project at the Illinois State University pointing out that as a nation, state governments in this country will spend 10.8% less on higher education this year than they did last year. And you look at our state here in Pennsylvania, 18.3% less than we spent last year. And you go, where'd that money go? You know, if we're not investing in higher education, if we're not investing in the future of our nation and our future of our most precious resource, our children, what are we doing with it? Oh, yeah, like he said, $1.7 billion to the grand cracker plant that was going to probably be built there anyway. It was just about free money. And now I see, you know, it's been almost 2 years, it's going on 2 years now that the professors at the state universities have been without a contract. Today had a big rally. Wendy Lynn Lee, professor of philosophy at Bloomsburg University, was there today. Wendy Lee, Lynn, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, it's nice to be here. I'm sorry if my throat is scratchy. I did a lot of yelling this morning.
I can imagine, you know, and there's a lot to yell about. I mean, I look at this report, 18.3% less in higher ed spending this year than last year, and you go, where's that money coming from? Oh, yeah, your paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And what frustrates me is, you know, some folks seem to be okay with it.
I think that if the public had a better understanding of just what that education is about, just what it is that they're getting for their money, I think that they would realize that our contract negotiations are much less about, for example, our salaries and much more about all of the other things that that money goes to pay for with respect to the quality of the kinds of programs that middle-class kids can get from state universities.
Yeah, but at the end of this, I mean, you're looking at this contract negotiation, it seemed to me to be more, and this is just an outsider's perspective from the reports and the folks that I've talked to, this seems more about ideology than actual numbers. I mean, I keep hearing, well, we're looking 20 years down the road or 30 years down. What if, what might, if Governor Corbett stays, if we make him King Corbett and these 18.3% cuts happen year after year after year, sorry, we're not going to be able to pay you or anybody else for that matter.
Oh, yeah. I have written about this some, and I think that I think that you're dead on. I think that this is very much ideological. And what I was just listening to a moment ago about the cracker plant in the southwest part of the state, it's all of a piece with the same ideology. To privatize public education is not really different than privatizing other kinds of what used to be public services, or privatizing public agencies, for example, the Department of Environmental Protection. These may be public servants, but these are public servants who are, for all practical purposes and intents, serving the purposes of what I regard as a profoundly corrupt Pennsylvania government in the interest of both privatizing public services and ensuring that campaign donors are paid off.
Yeah, I gotta be honest. You know, you bring up the corrupt government thing, and I there are times where I agree with my right wing friends that government's bad, and I say you're right. Conservative run government, that's bad. I mean, the Metcalfs, the Corbetts, Herzogs, all of these. I'm sorry, the way they've run things, not thrilled with.
No.
I can throw Rendell in there as well, and some of those folks as well. We're talking about any of these corporate people, I fear.
Oh, yeah, and I think the difference between, say, the kinds of corruption that we might have found in the Rendell government, and I was not a huge fan of Rendell either, but the difference is still that Corbett does, I think, essentially what he said he was going to do when the far right effectively elected him, when they elected him, that he was going to cut spending, that he was going to privatize. Now I think what we're actually living, at least for those folks who voted for him, is a kind of be careful what you wish for, because you just might very well get it. I don't think he has a shot at being reelected. I don't think he's got much shot there. I think that some investigations, both into DEP and Kathleen Kane's into Sandusky, I think are probably gonna doom Corbett. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't get someone equally as ideologically hell-bent on destroying Pennsylvania public service, public higher education.
Yeah, I think you're right, though. I mean, the one thing I guess I can give Corbett credit for is he told you what he was going to do, and he's been quite honest. I remember right when he took office, he had appointed a privatization commission, not to study what could be privatized, but to go after and privatize what could be done. So
yeah.
It wasn't a directive of let's find out what we can. It's a directive of go out and do it.
Yeah. I mean, when you consider his appointments, say Michael Kranzer, of the Department of Environmental Protection, these are guys who come from precisely the industries who not only donated to his campaign, right, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, but are also the guys who, in fact, how do I want to put it, who represent, who really epitomize the kind of privatizing that he promised he would do, so that Michael Kranzer's coming from Exelon, right, is no surprising appointment at all. I think Corbett's governorship is, from his point of view, just a rehearsal, kind of like it was for Tom Ridge. It's kind of a rehearsal for his real dream job, which is with big energy and big extraction.
Yeah, and where the big paychecks are, you're right. But, you know, here's the thing, Wendy. You know, and I look at this, and, you know, you bring up the privatization thing. And to bring this back to your contract and to the state universities, I've been saying for the longest time, education is the next place for privatization. what they've already done to higher ed on a number of levels with these for-profit universities. They're going to continue to do with the state system because this is one of the largest state systems of higher education in the country and one of the top in the world. You've got to privatize. There's a lot of profit to be made there. The same thing that they're doing with K through 12 as well. So is the contract that you're going, the fight that's going on right now, do you think that has anything to do with opening up that for-profit model that you see these other places?
Oh, my God, absolutely. Yeah, this is a subject. One of my colleagues, I have a very good colleague in the philosophy department at Bloom named Kurt Smith, and he and I have worked on issues like that, let's be the next Phoenix model of higher ed for some years now. When you look at what some of their contract proposals are and you sort of look at them in aggregate, right, how they all fit together, the kind of model that you see is a model where education is no longer about the acquisition of knowledge. It's no longer about art. It's no longer about the humanities. It's no longer about beauty. It's about filling as much as we possibly can, just enough to ensure that we have workers to supply to the industries that this government subsidizes.
Yeah, it's a commodity.
So, yeah, a commodity. So the state schools are effectively, they're not just training centers. They're more like public relations firms and machinery for the product of something called a student for a little while, but really just a worker who is precisely tooled for the industries that the governor wants to see privatized in the state. So, you know, that's something we have to both resist in the contract and at the local level as well, because we see a lot of creeping industrialization or Walmartification of our general education programs, for example, the dumbing down of education to turn students into widgets who don't ever ask a critical question ever in their lives.
Well, that's the country that the wealth class envisions. People just, and I think George Carlin said it 20 years ago, people smart enough to push the buttons and move the paper around, but not smart enough to ask why.
Yeah, and people just smart enough to push those buttons and move that paper and be perfectly satisfied, think that they've got genuinely free choices when, you know, they're picking between Coke and Pepsi, you know, on the shelves of the Walmart, that they will identify that kind of material acquisition with what freedom really is.
Yeah, a nation of epsilons.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, these are the people we had someone come, I guess it was about a year ago, to our campus to give a lecture about the natural gas boom in the state. And one of the things she said that I found most memorable and telling was that when she saw how much young people could make, and particularly in this case young men could make, driving rigs for the gas, as she put it, she looked right out onto this audience of students and she said, you know, you don't really need all of this, right? Here are the good paying jobs, and all that requires is, you know, 18 months, you know, and a fancy driver's license. And anyone who is an academic or actually thinks that education is more than training in that audience was horrified. Was just horrified.
Well, but it goes to show the exact mentality of the people who are making policy in this country. And you hear it on both sides of the aisle. I mean, it's about getting my generation, I'm 45. My generation was taught that was my only way into the middle class.
Yeah. 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 No, I'm 53. And I sometimes say to my fellows, and I fear greatly that it could be true, that I feel like my generation of academics is the last generation of real academics, at least in the humanities, where we still actually hold on to what seem increasingly quaint ideals about the beauty of ideas.
Which is why I think this contract right now is so important, because this is, to me, and just from an outsider's perspective, This, to me, is which direction are we going to go? I mean, we've seen the push towards privatizing, you know, every asset the state has. And I see the state system of higher education. I see these universities as assets of me and other taxpayers, of we the people. And to see them co-opted and see them destroyed infuriates me.
Yeah. Well, when you look at very particular aspects of the contract offer, for example, class size, and that's something that we take very, very seriously, maybe particularly in the humanities, but I think really across the colleges, across the curriculum, class size is very important to us because there are only so many students in a classroom that I can really, really reach and reach well, that I can educate. And especially in a philosophy class, which relies on dialogue and exchange, 150 students, you know, that's just a kind of absurdity to me. But, you know, part of what they would really like to see are much larger classes, right, that just no matter how hard we try are going to end up being dumbed down.
Yep.
And they would like to see more and more of those courses online and more of those courses taught by adjuncts. And so once you add all that together, what do you actually need a professoriate for? You don't really need a thoughtful, creative, researching professoriate if all you're really teaching is a little bit of intro to this and intro to that, just enough to say students can leave with a paper that says I'm edumacated.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm with you, and it's a scary prospect of what the future will be. And I had read something the other day that the next generation, my kids, they're going to be very quick at recalling very, very quick facts, very short facts, but actually being able to sit and think through complex problems is going to be a struggle for that generation.
Well, one of the differences between merely having access to information and actually having knowledge is being able to do something with the information and see the connection among facts, among ideas, to be able to critically evaluate what's put before you and not take it for granted that it's necessarily true until you can really come to comprehend it. We lose that. My argument is that we lose that. We lose public education, K through 12 and higher ed. We lose the democracy because a democracy depends upon a citizenry educated well enough to be able to make discerning and thoughtful votes.
Yep.
Without that, we don't have anything.
Yeah, absolutely. So last question then. What do we do to get this thing passed? I know the chancellor's leaving. Is that going to change any of the dynamics? Because, you know, it's been my thought that, you know, he's one of these ideologues who, you know, he's making a name for himself. So he made a good enough a name that he's going on to another job. What's this going to mean when he leaves?
I honestly don't think anyone has the answer to that question exactly yet because he hasn't left yet. No doubt it's going to change the dynamics, but in what direction, I think it's very hard to say. And I bet that it's hard to say on the other side, too. I bet they don't have a very clear beat on this either.
Right.
But the one thing I think I can say with some real confidence is that it doesn't alter the strategy on our side of this equation. For folks in APSCUS, right, the PASHE faculty union, I think I'm speaking pretty much for all of us when I say that what we're really committed to is a contract that is fair to us and that doesn't require us to sell out, right, which we're not going to do, right? We're just not going to do it. Sell out our adjunct faculty, our younger untenured faculty, or our retirees. At either end of the state's contract proposals is this part of the packages that we would sell out at one end or the other, that either retirement packages would be inadequate or that we're going to absolutely slash and burn the wages of
the next
adjunct
generation. Yeah.
We will not do that. So our strategy is going to remain the same. It will be interesting to see whether or not now that we've had this awesome demonstration this morning, this just excellent turnout of a demonstration this morning, it will be very interesting to see what they do next, because surely if they're smart, they can see that we are serious and we care so much about our university system and our students that we stood out there in the freezing cold today for several hours in order to get our message to them.
Well, I understand it was an outstanding event, a lot of good coverage. We've got pictures at our Facebook page. Put some up on the website. As this goes down the line, I would love to have you back and fill us in on where this is going. And I hope for a speedy and quick resolution to this because, you know, I love hearing people talk about certainty. It would be nice if we had some certainty for the students of the next semester.
Oh, yeah. We all have classes that we all would far and away prefer to be returning to. Nobody wants a strike.
Nope.
And there's nobody out here who likes the idea of a strike. But what we also know, cliched though it might sound, but it's true, is that the best way we can avoid this strike is to be loaded for bear in the event that we have to go out.
Now, the best defense is a good offense. Wendy,
yep.
I appreciate the time, and again, I'd love to have you back as this moves on down the road.
You bet.
Lynn Lee, professor of philosophy at Bloomsburg University. Thanks so much. Quick break. Back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Perhaps you thought that surely the far right wing and American politics couldn't get any nuttier. If so, you clearly hadn't factored in Glenn Beck. Since losing his story spot as a Fox TV yakety yakker, Beck has been less visible, but no less busy, continuing to promote himself as the leader of the political wacky and still delighting them as the P.T. Barnum of conspiracy theories. His hottest-selling shtick in recent months is a piece of fear-mongering about an entity that few other people in the world consider at all fearsome, the United Nations. Agenda 21, wails the Beckster on his subscription TV show and other forums, referring to an obscure, innocuous, and non-binding resolution approved by UN members, including the U.S., 21. Years ago. Be very afraid, Beck bleats in alarm. Out the sea guys are promoting sustainable development, goes the theory. The United Nations intends to ban our suburbs, take our golf courses from us, usurp our freedoms, and impose a global dictatorship. To depict the horror of Agenda 21, the cover of Beck's new book on the topic features the UN logo looming over an American landscape which is imprisoned behind barbed wire. Subtle. Silly, too, but it's the hot new thing on the far right. Heroic lawmakers in Alabama and Tennessee have already banned any implementation of Agenda 21-style provisions in their states, even though none were proposed. Five other state legislatures are considering the same this year. And the big rumor on the right is that Barack Obama is using CIA mind control techniques to implement the UN dictatorship. This is Jim Hajar saying, do these people ever even visit reality?
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
I couldn't make a statement in all good faith and say to you that there is no voter fraud in the United States. and there's no voter fraud in Pennsylvania.
Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows.
Ah, yes. Can't possibly make that statement. Well, you know, the statement of fact kind of did. Just a thought. And you know, you look at what's going on here. Here in Pennsylvania, right now as we speak, the proposition of House Bill 94, where they're already lining up to steal the 2016 election. We don't even know who the candidates are going to be yet, even though there's been some polling on it. It's only been a couple of days Obama was inaugurated. We're already polling who's going to be the 2016 nominees. And at this point, Hillary Clinton has the edge, in favorability, 67-26%. Vice President Biden, 48-35. Clinton saw a strongly favorable to strongly unfavorable rate, 35-14. Biden right down the middle, 22-23. And now you see this story that Mark Zuckerberg, the guy, the Facebook guy, going to hold a fundraiser for Chris Christie. Already lining this stuff up. But here's the thing. With all the money that's going to flow into it, they still can't buy it. So they're going to end up stealing it. And I look at this House Bill 94, which is, what we talked about a little bit earlier. This idea that we're going to change how we have allocated electors to the Electoral College, for 230-odd years. We should change it. Why? Because, as the numbers bear out, Romney would have won had we done it. And this isn't just specific to Pennsylvania. There are other states doing it, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Virginia, Florida, another one where there's talk that this could happen. And it's all aimed at, Republicans don't have the votes. They just don't. So what you have to do is take the gerrymandering that you got and use it to your advantage. And I look at some of the electoral maps. And Ian Millhiser over at Think Progress put up a really interesting graph. And it shows, it shows the states, Florida, Michigan, Ohio, and it shows the margin of victory for the president. For instance, in Michigan, where Obama, the margin of victory was almost 10%, 9.5%. And Democrats only control five of the 15 seats. Here in Pennsylvania, Democrats control where Obama won by well over 5%. 5 of the 18 seats. Virginia, where Obama won by 3%. 3 of the 11 seats went to Democrats, all because of this gerrymandering. If you look at the maps, it is amazing. In Wisconsin, A little bit, the gerrymandering, not so much, but you look at, not as much, but you look at the almost 7% Obama won. They only carried 3 of the 8 congressional seats. So if you then go back and you redo the math, and this is what's important, if you do the electoral math, Romney wins. That's what's going on. That's what's happening right now. And it's not just something that happened here in Pennsylvania. Oh, somebody got an idea. No. This is a national strategy. Much like the nonsensical open workforce initiative or whatever euphemistic name they're giving it. This is a well-funded, well-backed, long-term plan of the wealth class in this country to consolidate power. And I'm telling you, it blows my mind at how much of all of this all looks the same. Because it's the handful. It's the handful that are leading this charge to take away our rights. going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about, you know, the union density numbers being down. What's our future look like? We're going to look to the past. Quick break, right back after this.
Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, the world's deepest lake.
Russia's Lake Baikal. The water's average depth is more than 700 meters, almost half a mile. In some places, Lake Baikal is more than twice as deep as that.
Lake Baikal is also the oldest lake in the world. It began forming when a fissure in the Eurasian continent opened more than 25 million years ago.
If you exclude polar ice caps and glaciers, Lake Baikal holds over one-fifth of all surface fresh water on Earth. Unlike other deep lakes, it contains dissolved oxygen right down to the lake floor. That means creatures can thrive at all depths in the lake.
Most of Lake Baikal's 2,000-plus species of plants and animals are found nowhere else in the world. Scientists believe up to 40% of the lake's species haven't been described yet. Species endemic to Lake Baikal have evolved over tens of thousands or millions of years. They occupy ecological niches that were undisturbed until the last few decades.
Now, industrial development, paper mills, mining, agriculture, and general population growth on the lake's shores are putting toxic compounds, fertilizers, and other pollutants into Lake Baikal. Find out how scientists are studying how the lake is changing at earthsky.org. Search for the words deepest lake. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
That's something you haven't heard an awful lot about here recently, the Employee Free Choice Act. And I got to be honest, I truly believe, and I know this will probably upset a bunch of women, I don't think Lilly Ledbetter should have been the first piece of legislation. I think the Employee Free Choice Act should have been. Because you want to stop women from getting cheated on the job? Give them a contract. You want to stop it from happening in the first place? Instead of going retroactively, you can go back after them? Stop it right from the beginning. At least that's my thought on it. And you look at the numbers, the Bureau of Labor Statistic numbers out now, 11.3% union membership dropped down to 11.3%, 6.6 in the private sector. And some of the numbers that caught my attention, Wisconsin lost 46,000 union members. Why? Because you got a governor there hell-bent on destroying the. Look at Indiana, hell-bent on destroying them, lost 56,000. Pennsylvania, wake up. If Daryl Metcalf and his extreme ilk like Stephen Bloom get their way, we're next. I'll guarantee you next year Pennsylvania will lose that many if they get their way. And look, those are jobs that keep the economy going. But my fear is that we're returning to the good old days, the days of the past, where hooray for me and screw you is the will of the wealth class, and you and I, well, we're the ones who fight each other for the crumbs. So I think possibly we're returning to the days of Lochner, but, you know, you look at the Roberts Court, could be the new and improved version. That's why I've asked Eric Fink, associate professor at Elon University, to come talk to us about that era and, you know, where we're going with these numbers. Eric, thanks for taking time for
us. Hi, Rick. Nice to be here.
You know, I look at this and I see these numbers and I see the decline going on right before my very eyes, and yet I still see the Metcalfs of the world and I see the Walkers and all these people attacking and demonizing workers, the whole point being to completely eviscerate and destroy them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. They want to make sure that workers have exactly no voice, so that they can just run roughshod over people.
And then we push this individual. Well, you have the liberty of contract. They said, you know, you can make your own deal. And you know, I keep bringing up this Lochner Court, and a lot of people, you know, my listeners have heard this before, because I see us going back to that era where there's no minimum wage, there's no maximum hour law, there's no health and safety, there's none of this stuff. There's just, hey, you made the agreement, you're on your own, brother.
Yeah, very much, and of course the real thing about that Lochner era is that the Supreme Court in the Lochner case tried to justify this as freedom for the workers. Oh, this is great for the workers. If we have laws protecting workers against abusive conditions, oh, that's unfreedom. That's taking away the workers' liberty. And we see that same thing now, you know, nowadays. You know, I teach law. When I went to law school for years, everybody pointed at Lochner as the worst thing that the Supreme Court had ever done. Even Robert Bork agreed that it was a terrible decision. You're now seeing some of these right-wing legal scholars pointing back and saying, no, Lochner's terrific. We really need to go back to that. So I think there's a very deliberate move in certain circles to bring us back to that era.
Well, walk me back through that, because, you know, because you're right. We're hearing the same thing. Well, it's your freedom, and you shouldn't have been, you know, those oppressive unions. And I mean, to me, I look at this, and their rhetoric is laughable, but unfortunately, there are folks who are listening to it.
Yeah, no, and it works exactly through rhetoric. The whole idea is you talk about liberty of contract, you talk about freedom, and you make it seem as though when workers join a union and act together, that's somehow oppressive, that's somehow restricting the freedom of workers. Of course, how do unions work? You know this, Rick. Unions work through contracts. If you really believe in the freedom to contract, what you should really believe is that workers should have the full freedom to contract collectively, if that's what they choose to do. But that's exactly what, you know, these right-wing folks don't want to happen. When they say liberty of contract, that's just mumbo jumbo. They don't really mean it.
Yeah, and the other part of it is if you take it to the next step, what they really want with their no rights at work agenda and the laws that they try and pass is to make it that you can't make a contract to say that, you know, people who are going to work on this job, they're going to be members. No security clauses. You can't even negotiate that.
No, that's precisely right. I live, you know, I used to live up in Pennsylvania, a strong union state. I now live in North Carolina, the least unionized state in the United States, and one of the first states to pass so-called right to work. And you see the results here. It's a state where working people really have no rights, and where employers really get their way.
And I gotta be honest, you know, in my reading of the era, in question, you know, back, you know, to the 1880s through, you know, the Lochner of, what, 1905 to 1910,
yeah.
That period there up until the 30s, you know, I don't know that I want to go back to that. I don't know that I want my children to have to go back and refight those battles, but it appears to me is that unfortunately we may have to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, think about what this was. I mean, we talk about the Lochner case. You know, what the Lochner case was about, of course, was New York State passed a law regulating the hours of work for bakery workers. They did this for the health and safety of bakery workers. It wasn't that bakery workers was the most dangerous work, but it was an example. The Supreme Court struck down that law, and they struck down other laws like that, saying that it violated the workers' freedom. Of course, what they really were concerned about was freedom to exploit workers, but they framed it in those terms. Yeah. A few years later, they struck down laws. Many states had passed laws outlawing yellow dog contracts, outlawing contracts that says you agree when you come to work for me that you won't join a union. Many states said that's absurd. People should have a freedom to join a union. Supreme Court says, oh, no, it violates the workers' freedom. Workers should have the freedom to sign away that right.
Yeah, and you
that's
look at,
exactly the same rhetoric we're seeing now.
And it's interesting you bring that up because tomorrow is the day that the Supreme Court upheld these yellow dog contracts, basically saying you're never going to join, and if you do, you're fired immediately. And I wonder today how many people would say, well, okay, I'll sign it.
Oh, but, you know, when people need a job and when people are in an economy like we had in the early 20th century and like we have again in the early 21st century, where jobs are real hard to come by, of course people will agree to just about anything to get a job. And to say that that's a free choice, to say that that's voluntary, is just ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that go, what's the choice? The choice is to starve or not to starve.
No, that's exactly right. Now, you know, there's a real irony as I was thinking about this and getting ready to talk to you this day. I was looking back over some of these cases. You know, eventually Congress finally went back, and with the Norris-LaGuardia Act, they again said they outlawed these yellow dog contracts. Then quickly we had the Wagner Act, we had the flowering of the modern labor movement, and then we started to have that reaction of the so-called right-to-work laws in states in the South. In 1949, the Supreme Court, for the first time, upheld the legality of the so-called right-to-work laws, and they did something very interesting in that case. They tried to draw an analogy between a union security clause and a yellow dog contract. And the Supreme Court said, these are the same. These are both unfair. You know, if we're going to outlaw yellow dog contracts, we also have to outlaw contracts that require workers to pay their fair share. So it's very interesting historically how this contract language has consistently been manipulated against workers.
It is interesting. And, you look at this court that we have right now, you look at the Roberts Court, and, I read something not too long ago that of the cases before the court involving the Chamber of Commerce, who one could argue is, basically the lobbyist arm of corporate America, that the Supreme Court had decided, it was like 71-74% on the side of the Chamber of Commerce. Very business-friendly court, and not very worker-friendly. I mean, if you look at some of the cases that have come out, the Rent-A-Center case comes to my mind, where if there's a contract, if you sign something on the day you're employed that you'll go to arbitration instead of suing them, you're going to an arbitrator that they choose. Hey, your right's gone.
Absolutely. They're taking away the work. They're taking away the protections. They're taking away the ability of workers to get their day in court and challenge illegal conduct among employers. And employers are doing this, again, using these contracts.
Yeah, and that's what scares me about this Supreme Court.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's another case. They just heard arguments. It's going to come out about about minimum wage cases and overtime violations. And again, my expectation is that the Supreme Court is again going to rule that employers can manipulate. They can offer, a quick settlement to the lead plaintiff and prevent people from bringing class action lawsuits, collective action lawsuits for minimum wage violations. Every place where workers, and it's not only workers, of course, it's also workers in their status
as consumers. Yep.
Every place that it's ordinary people against corporations, the Supreme Court is trying to close that courthouse door.
And, it's one of those things where you go, where do you then turn? I mean, if the court system is not going to be the place where you're going to get justice, where do you go?
Exactly right. You know, there's a reason that Congress in the 30s started to change the law to make it possible for people to join unions. It wasn't just out of the goodness of their heart, but they also recognized that, if people have the some voice, if people have the ability to air their grievances in a reasonable way, it's less likely they're going to resort to violence and disorder. Well, when you start to take away all the legitimate places, I'm not sure where people have to turn.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where, you know, when the Tea Party thing happened, right at the beginning, when that spark happened, because there was, at the very beginning, there I do believe there was a moment of grassroots anger before it was co-opted by the wealth class. I was out in the street with those people going, you're absolutely right, we have been screwed, but what's the answer? And then almost immediately they took this rightward pro-business, oh, it's the union's fault, it's the government's fault, it's everything but the real culprit.
Well, that's right. That's another classic tech pit, working person against working person, make them point the finger at each other, whether they use, you know, the unions as a scapegoat or race or gender or anything else as a scapegoat, anything to get people to point their finger other than at the, you know, the powers that really are, you know, causing it all this oppression.
So in looking back, I mean, in comparing the history to today, you know, what worked, what got us to the point where we were then and out of that era, as a lesson for today, what is it that got us where we were, which is hopefully where we're going to be back at some point? What did we do?
Well, I mean, what happened between, you know, 1905, 1915, when we had this Lochner era, and then the mid-1930s when we got Norris, LaGuardia, and Wagner, what happened is that unions were crushed, unions were, you know, shrunk down to numbers like we see today, and then started to organize again. It started to be very militant. We had the sit-down strikes. We had some very violent strikes. I hope it doesn't come to that level of violence, but I think that the only possible way forward is to not just look at these numbers and give up and say, okay, unions are dead, but to say, no, we've really got to fight. We've really got to get more militant. Unions have to get more creative and start to build back up that pressure so that the people in power have to respond.
Yeah. Are you encouraged by what you're seeing in New York with the fast food workers, in Chicago with the restaurant workers and the Our Walmart people? Are you encouraged by those things?
Very much. I mean, these are the most marginalized workers probably in this country. And these are the workers who everyone has said for decades, the most impossible to organize. And in some ways, they're doing the most interesting and creative and forward-looking organizing. And I think that if these efforts can really take off, and if other unions will really pay attention to this, I think there's real potential, just like there was in the early 1930s, at a time when people also were saying, oh, the unions are dead. That was so, you know, that unions are so 19th century.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're in a similar position today. I hope so.
Yeah, I'm hoping as well, but the thing is we're hearing the exact same messaging, and I think you've highlighted that. I appreciate it, Eric. Thanks so much. Did you hang up on him already? Eric Fink, associate professor at Elon University. I appreciate it. It was great talking about it. Let's take a quick break. I'm interested in your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
We gotta get older tonight. We gotta do it.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center. For more information, visit www.therickschmidtshow.com.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-74, ricksmithshow.com. You know, I think about that, and you look at this Supreme Court, and you look at all of the, and look, this is 40 years in the making. I mean, this is not something that just happened overnight. And as we talked about last night, you know, it's one thing you know, they gave women the right to vote. They're giving gays some rights. They gave African Americans some rights. It's one thing to give people, give them a little bit of something, quell them. But when you're talking about giving workers the right to get some of that pot that they create, oh boy, that ain't gonna happen. And you know, you go back to that era when some labor law did happen. Because you did. You had organizing. You had people who had come out of they were going through the Depression. They were saying, and as I've been saying, there's only so much of you-know-what people are willing to eat. And when you have nothing left to lose, you're going to take to the streets. And we were seeing that in the back then. And as Eric pointed out, you know, we had the sit-down strikes, and we had those that bloody history. Because people were willing to go to the streets and really fight for it. So they had to do something. And as soon as they did, it's my view that the business community, we got to figure out how do we stop this? And almost immediately they were going, hey, that's when the Republican Party got co-opted. And what'd they do? Well, they passed Taft-Hartley over the veto of President Truman. Which gave them the ability to push this right to work nonsense. And every step since has been chipping away, court decision after court decision, chipping away. And then you move up to the Reagan years, where they started using those executive orders and started using some of the agencies, the NLRB, to go after and basically saying, hey, go ahead. You know, I just found out that the Kentucky River case, the Kentucky River contract has finally been settled. It's been how many years now? And you go, well, why is that familiar? Oh, yeah. The NLRB back during the Bush years where they decided that, you know, people doing 10, 15 minutes work worth of supervisory work a day. Well, they're not supervisors. And they're not able to, to be part of the contract, to be part of the bargaining unit. And again, using those agencies against us. For what aim, though? Well, pretty simple. Keeping the pot. And I go back to the numbers that I pointed out earlier about Walmart's. Stop and think about that for a second. Six people. Six people who've never really created anything for society. They won the lottery, basically. With a combined wealth of more than half of the Forbes 400 from 1982 when you adjust for inflation. Think about that consolidation. And I go back to, and as I said earlier, I go back to my grandparents' generation and the job my grandmother had. You know where their wealth came from? You know where those six got their money from? Well, a good portion of it were the wages my grandmother's generation used to make. Where those wages and those benefits, that health care, that pension, those sick days, that vacation, all that stuff was taken away. And what happened to it? It flowed upward. And then you ended up with what? You ended up with Desperation Nation, which is where we're headed. When you look at the numbers, and 400,000 union jobs lost last year. In states like Wisconsin, in states like Indiana, where the goal is to go after those teachers and go after those cops. Here in Pennsylvania, over the last couple of years, we've lost 20,000 teachers and support staff. Why? Because we've got a governor that's cutting education budgets. Is that the way forward? And at every turn, the proposals I see from the extreme right is about taking us back to those days of the 1880s, the 1890s, back to those days where people like you and me, we didn't stand a chance. And the same rhetoric applied. Well, if you just work hard, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I love some of the imagery you see. Like McDonald's, for instance. You know, a worker at McDonald's will have to work 1 million hours to earn what the CEO there takes. And I think of that billionaire, Gina Reinhart, from Australia, who's advocating a $2 an hour minimum wage, telling people that they need to smoke less and socialize less and work harder. For $2 an hour, are you ever going to be a billionaire for two? No. But I guess that's easy when you've won the sperm lottery. This is where I say, you know, we need to be talking about pushing back against the no rights at work agenda. Pushing back against the further destruction of labor law. Pushing back against the destruction of public education. Pushing back against the destruction of retirement security. At every turn, what we see is going back to the good old days. I guess the question becomes, is are we going to put up with it? Are we going to stand for it? And the hope is we don't. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com, that's where you go get the podcast. Also, if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. You can take the program on the go. Also, always email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. You know, I got a couple of really interesting ones I want to get to in the next hour, and I just can't get it out of my head. Bubblegum-flavored apples. Think about that. All natural, they tell me. Bubblegum-flavored apples. Quick break. Back with Hour 3.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Amalgamated Transit Union says the public isn't getting accurate information from New York City's mayor about the impact of the school bus strike. The week-old strike was triggered when the city tried to strip job protections from the contract. ATU says the mayor is refusing to negotiate with the union. The New York State AFL-CIO and the New York City Central Labor Council are both supporting the strike. The union says city council members have supported the striking workers, and the workers are also meeting with parents' groups who support them. The union says it's making sure that parents have accurate information about the strike, and the ATU says it's winning the ground game. ATU says the mayor's claim that it's illegal to put employee protection provisions in the new contract is false. ATU says no court has ruled that those protections are illegal. The union also says the mayor is wrong when he says he can't negotiate with the union. ATU says there is a 34-year record of the city negotiating employee protection provisions with the union. The mayor wants to strip workers of job protections by bidding out school bus contracts to private companies that could then fire workers, lower wages, or strip away benefits. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the overall percentage of American workers in unions dropped to just 11.3% in 2012. That's down from 11.8% in 2011. Unions lost 400,000 members in 2012. All told, there are 14,366,000 union workers in the U.S. Unions represent just 6.6% of all private sector workers in the U.S. The Laborers International Union of North America is urging swifter action on implementing new rules to protect workers from silica exposure. Jesse Russell reports.
For nearly 100 years, workers have been suffering from silica exposure on the job. During that time, there has been a great deal of discussion about the lung disease and cancer that can result from the exposure, but little has been done. In 1997, OSHA began drafting new rules, which weren't sent to the White House's Office of Management and Budget until February of 2011. To date, those rules have yet to be released to the public for review. And once they are made public, it could take years of lengthy public hearings before they're made official. Every year, an estimated 280 workers succumb to silica-related illnesses. The Laborers International Union of North America has published a petition on the White House We the People website, hoping to generate 25,000 signatures necessary to trigger a response from the president. In a statement, the union said that while the government continues to delay on taking action, thousands of workers are being exposed to silica, guaranteeing more deaths and illness.
This newscast is made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW and from the OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
That the whole world begins to see what's going on right here. That there is tremendous amounts of money being spent in the industry. I've seen amounts of money, and you're the one that's suffering.
Welcome back to the third hour of the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Get the podcast there or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So, you know, you look at these numbers, and as bad as they are, I think things could get a lot worse if we don't continue to push back, if we don't get out in the streets and do the organizing as we've done in the past. But as bad as they are, there's still some bright spots in here, which is why I've asked Dave Johnson, organizing director for the National Nurses United Union, to come and talk to us about some of the victories that they've had, even in face of all of the attacks that are going on right now. David, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. You know, I look at all of this, and, you know, there's part of me that thinks, you know, this release of these numbers plays right into the right wing's hands of saying, see, things are on the decline, and could end up actually causing a further spiral. I'm curious your thought.
Well, I think to some extent these numbers reflect the, you know, the coordinated attack by these huge corporations that dominate our country on unions and working people more generally. But in particular, of course, the attacks in the well-known attacks in states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio, where the corporations, you know, have gotten these politicians to go after the right of working people to organize and fight back. But I think the, you know, there are some really bright spots here. I think there's a lot of hope out there that people are fed up and looking for change, looking for ways to fight back, and that's certainly been our experience in the National Nurses United.
You know, I've talked to folks, and, you know, there's a sense that I get that people have hit that point or hitting that point where, you know, there's only so much of, you know, what people are willing to eat, and they're fed up, and they're looking for, you know, how do we change this? How do we? And I look to history, you know, after the World War, when my grandparents' generation came back from World War II, I think it was the same, almost the same sentiment. We want to share some of the wealth. We want to be able to support our families, have a reasonable future and a reasonable retirement. I don't think that's too much to ask.
Well, I certainly agree, and certainly the nurses who are organizing into NNU by the thousands agree. I mean, I think there is just a pent-up level of frustration with the way people are getting pushed around and the way, in the case of our organization, the way nurses are being attacked, not only in terms of wages and benefits, but, you know, probably more importantly, in terms of their ability to safely staff the hospitals and to be able to carry out the patient care that is the reason why nurses went into the profession in the first place.
Yeah, you know, and the number of nurses we've talked to over the years, you know, it's rarely about money. It's rarely about benefits. It's about, just as you pointed out, the care and the ability to care for their patients. Because, you know, I remember when my father-in-law was in the hospital, the one ICU nurse had like six rooms. And you go, how is it possible in this kind of an intense setting to be able to actually care for people when you're running around like that?
Well, and you know, the real tragedy here is that the reason that hospitals in so many cases, so many places are understaffed is because they're dancing to the tune of Wall Street here.
Right.
They're trying to, you know, their focus is the bottom line increasingly, and not on the care of the patients, and the end result is too many times is understaffing and really bad conditions for nurses and for patients. And it's those conditions that are really driving nurses to organize around the country. Since NNU was founded 3 years ago, we've organized over 40 hospitals and 15,000 registered nurses, and that number is growing rapidly. And it really is that frustration with not being able to provide the kind of patient care that they want and need to be able to provide.
And that's, in my opinion, the only way you're going to push back against Wall Street and this for-profit model that we've been saddled with.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think registered nurses are recognizing all around the country that when they're dealing with corporate health care, when they're dealing with hospital administrations that really are just so focused on the bottom line, the only way to have safe staffing, the only way to have respect for the professional registered nurses, the only way to be able to provide the kind of patient care that patients require is to have a strong union in the workplace to be able to stand up for nurses and make sure that their voices are heard and respected.
Now, I would argue it's not just nurses. It's every working person. It's every person who punches a clock, collects a paycheck, or does work for anybody.
Well, I certainly agree with you there. And I think our hope, of course, is that so many nurses are organizing. One of the great things about registered nurses is not only are they caring people, but they are, you know, they're in every community in this country. They are well-respected professionals. Their work and their caring touches so many lives, and it's certainly our hope that that nurses organizing to fight back against these against this corporate health care and against really the Wall Street agenda in this country will inspire other workers to take the same actions.
Now, let me ask you, as you're in your role as organizing director for the National Nurses United, in your years, how have things changed? I mean, you know, we see a lot of stories about how broken and fractured our labor laws are, yet your union is still organizing and you know, getting contracts. Where do you see the changes, where they've gone, and where do you see things going?
Well, I think there's no question that for workers to try and organize a union today, the laws are stacked against them, and it has gotten worse in my time in the labor movement, significantly worse. I mean, you know, it really, in this country, it's supposed to be a right. In fact, it's supposed to be a right encouraged by the federal government for workers to form unions and engage in collective bargaining. And unfortunately, that right has long since been just a right on paper, which when you try and exercise, companies will come down on you. I think, though, that in the case of nurses, I talk about nurses because those are the folks that we're working to organize. The thing that motivates them to fight back against this, companies, hospital companies that don't want them to organize, is a real sense that if they're going to change things in their hospitals and for their patients, it is going to take a strong organization. And frankly, I think they're fed up. And I think there may be a broader thing here, too, where I think it's not just nurses who are fed up. I think, you know, working class people in general in this country are fed up.
Yep. And to me, I got to be, my hope is that, and I keep going back to my grandparents' generation, the World War II generation, because, you know, it was something that was ingrained in their culture. And a friend of mine just showed me a picture from one of the rallies they had in Wisconsin, and a guy was holding up a sign saying, you know, you'll take my union card from my cold dead hand, you know, kind of going off the gun thing. And there's part of me that thinks we have to have that back to where, as the gun people are, you know, they're willing to throw down, working people have to do as well.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that, you know, sometimes I think that the, you know, there's a problem sometimes in the labor movement with a narrowness of vision or of inspiration here. I mean, you know, the reality is that what's going on in this country is a terrible crime against the people who built this country, who build it every day and care for people. You know, when you look at the kind of attacks on wages, on trying to eliminate our pension plans, you know, throwing people out of jobs, people out of their homes, decimating our education system. When you look at what should be outraged, then they should be in the streets. And, of course, some of them have been, and, for example, in Occupy Wall Street is an example of that. But we think there needs to be a lot more of that.
I'm right there with you, and I've been calling for it for the longest time. But I guess this is just my personal view on this. My problem is I think a lot of this stuff gets overlooked. The anger gets overlooked because we've directed it at that black guy in the White House.
Well, you know, I think you have to say that the corporations have done a masterful job at hiding where the real problem is. There's all this stuff about, you know, government's the problem and, you know, the guy in the White House or the people in Congress are the problem. You know, and to a certain extent, there are obviously there are a number of politicians in both parties who do nothing but the bidding of these corporations. But, you know, the root of the problem is not it's not political, it's economic. And I think that, you know, for example, the agenda that's ruined this country here over the last few years is the Wall Street agenda.
Yep.
And that's an agenda that's been supported by politicians in both parties. And it's only going to be an agenda that gets turned around if working people take on that Wall Street agenda. And that's one of the reasons why our organization has launched a movement for what we call the Robin Hood tax, which is to make Wall Street begin to pay for the devastation they've caused in our communities. The idea is simple, that tax on stock trades and derivatives, and begin to invest that money back into our communities so that people have jobs and housing and a decent life, which we are entitled to.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. In fact, as I understand it, right now as we speak, it's about to be introduced. Harkin from Iowa and DeFazio from Oregon, I believe, are going to be introducing this transaction tax, 0.03%. But I look at this and I go, well, you know, in the 11 nations in the EU, they got a 0.1% transaction tax.
Well, we have legislation that Congressman Keith Ellison from Minnesota introduced last year, the Robin Hood tax legislation, which is going to be shortly reintroduced, would tax these, begin to tax these stock trades at a reasonable rate that could actually raise, we believe, $350 billion a year from the pockets of Wall Street back into our communities. That's the piece of legislation that's the embodiment of the Robin Hood tax. And, you know, we're working with folks around the globe, actually, to get this introduced, as you said, in the EU and other places in the world. And it's way past time for Wall Street to pay their fair share here in the United States.
It just makes sense to me. I mean, you know, you stop and think about all of the money that and all of the resource that they drained from this economy through their malfeasance and through their incompetence. And I shouldn't even say that. I mean, they were very competent in what they were doing. I believe they knew exactly what they were doing, robbing us blind.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, there has been and is a well-developed plan that involves transferring billions of dollars from our pockets, from our jobs, from our communities into the pockets of Wall Street. And it's not an accident that these things have happened. What needs to happen is an organized movement to begin to fight this to fight this trend. And I think, you know, registered nurses are a key part of that movement because they are situated in a place where it's really literally a question of life and death in these hospitals, whether or not nurses have the kind of organization that can support them as they speak out for patients. And we believe that patient advocacy, which is what registered nurses do every day, can't just be limited to the bedside. It also has to take place in society. Nurses have to advocate for patients in our communities throughout the country, as well as directly at the bedside.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And something I've been saying we need to be working on as day after day, as my grandparents' generation did. It was part of who they were. It was part of their culture. And yet I'm seeing this disturbing trend from the wealth class funding these attacks on us, and it's got to stop, which is why I'm glad to see that there's organizing going on. There are people in the streets, and you guys are part of it. Dave Johnson, I appreciate the time.
Yeah, you know, one thing you should just, you know, give your listeners a little bit of hope here. I mean, it's this organizing is going on in places like Texas and Florida, places that are not traditional hotbeds of organizing. You know, 5 years ago, there wasn't a single hospital in Texas where nurses had a union contract, and nurses have been on the move there. We got six hospitals now where union RNs in our union have improved their conditions, and nurses are organizing not only for to win union contracts, but also to win better staffing in hospitals, and some of the demands that again not only help nurses but patients. And I'll tell you this: if Texas nurses can be part of leading this fight back, that says a lot about the potential for workers in this country really making the kind of change that is long overdue.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Maybe we can get get you guys here in Pennsylvania to do some more of that as well. Dave, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Times so desperate measures we explore, marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out,
"Where's our government?"
Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance, public divided even the law was all they hated. Walking billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have took into account
that we never give up.
We'll be here one day longer.
Experience where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Perhaps you thought that surely the far right wing in American politics couldn't get any nuttier. If so, you clearly hadn't factored in Glenn Beck. Since losing his glory spot as a Fox TV yakety-yacker, Beck has been less visible, but no less busy, continuing to promote himself as leader of the political wacky and still delighting them as the P.T. Barnum of conspiracy theories. His hottest-selling shtick in recent months is a piece of fear-mongering about an entity that few other people in the world consider at all fearsome, the United Nations. Agenda 21, wails the Beckster on his subscription TV show and other forums, referring to an obscure, innocuous, and non-binding resolution approved by UN members, including the U.S., 21 years ago. Be very afraid, Beck bleats in alarm, for this document lays out the secret, diabolical scheme of internationalists to seize America's autonomy. Under the guise of promoting sustainable development, goes the theory, the United Nations intends to ban our suburbs, take our golf courses from us, usurp our freedoms, and impose a global dictatorship. To depict the horror of Agenda 21, the cover of Beck's new book on the topic features the UN logo looming over an American landscape which is imprisoned behind barbed wire. Subtle. Silly, too. but it's the hot new thing on the far right. Heroic lawmakers in Alabama and Tennessee have already banned any implementation of Agenda 21-style provisions in their states, even though none were proposed. Five other state legislatures are considering the same this year. And the big rumor on the right is that Barack Obama is using CIA mind control techniques to implement the UN dictatorship. This is Jim Hightower saying, do these people ever even visit reality?
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
What do you believe would be the repercussions for Democrats if they end up losing in the recall election?
I think, honestly, there aren't going to be any repercussions.
We ain't dumping no more prima donnas. You want to call the National Guard? Let's get it popping. What happens in Wisconsin will stay in Wisconsin. Mr. President.
Oh, that'll be nothing. Don't worry about it. That'll happen. You know what? How many thousands of jobs was it? 46,000? Yeah, it's not a big deal. Not a big deal. Man. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. One of the things we've been talking about for years on this program, this whole beggar thy neighbor economic development. Where I live, a company that had been in that community 93 years. Up and moved to Tennessee. And it was the money. It was a whole boatload of money. It was tens of millions of dollars. The promise of free land and, you know, all kinds of stuff. I mean, just a whole bunch of sweeteners and a whole bunch of taxpayer largesse, if you will. Well, the folks at Good Jobs First, who do these reports every so often about how bad this stuff is, put out another one. And they're saying, you know, look, you know, all of these incentives, it's simply a waste of taxpayer dollars. All of this money, it's wasteful. They say there are three problems with the strategy of going on and courting these corporations, basically stealing them from one state or another by promising them a whole bunch of stuff. They write that it's wasteful because the costs are high, the benefits are low. A tiny number of companies get huge subsidies, but the net impact of interstate job relocations is microscopic. They say the net effect of these piracy lures and blackmail payoffs is to divert economic development resources away from helping companies expand or start up, where virtually all the job growth action is. And, you know, you go and you look at a lot of these schemes and you look at all of this money that's handed out. And I think I've talked about this before. I remember growing up in Cleveland in the 80s where the idea was we're going to go after all of these Fortune 500 companies and we're going to promise them the world. 25-year tax abatements. The city of Cleveland owned Muni Light. So you free power. Sewer and water and all of this stuff. We're gonna give the baby of the bathwater away all at the same time. And what did you see happen? We saw these big companies come because at one point I think Cleveland had they were like fifth or sixth on the list of the number of Fortune 500 companies who had their headquarters there, which is pretty impressive when you think about L.A., Chicago, New York. Houston, you think of these huge cities that have a lot of these big companies. You think Cleveland, why there? It's cold. It's really cold. It's the money. And without fail, they would bring their headquarters there. They brought their workforce with them. So it didn't really bring jobs for the people that live there. And by giving away the tax base, you ended up giving away the schools, the roads, the infrastructure, and ended up shifting that burden onto the local people who needed those jobs that didn't come. So with one hand, you say, well, we're creating jobs, but, by stealing from someone else. And when it doesn't materialize, who ends up footing the bill? Well, the taxpayer does. And you know, you keep looking at all of these schemes that they keep coming up with. It's always to feed the very wealthy. It's always to feed the big corporations. And the reality is these schemes rarely pay off for you and me. And right now they're tearing down that building where that company was there for 93 years, employed hundreds of workers with decent wages. I mean, you could support a family on them. And what'd they do? They moved to Tennessee and the wages went down. So as a nation, what did we gain? We gained nothing. As a nation, we actually lost. Because tax dollars went to a big corporate, to a company, for no real reason, other than that they've got a nice new shiny facility that was paid for by taxpayers in another state, who, by the way, take more federal tax dollars from the federal government than they pay in. So in essence, you and I, we're funding this nonsense. And you go, when do we wake up? When do we realize that it's nothing but it's a con? All of the rhetoric that we hear from the right, all of the rhetoric that we hear from the corporate Democrats and the conservative Republicans about, oh, we need to help business grow by giving them huge sums of money. I'm sorry, that's not how it works. And there's report after report after study that shows this stuff just does not work. But what do we end up doing? The same thing over and over and over again. And why? Because that's what the moneyed interests want. That's the direction they keep pounding us. Because I still have people talking about we need tax cuts because tax cuts spur the economy. I asked the question, well, tax cuts for who? Well, for the people who have money, the very wealthy. Well, show me that where that's happened. Where has it worked? It hasn't. I mean, all of the stuff, and we're still talking about it. I guess I give the right credit. You give the business community credit. They get on a message and they stay with it. Even in the face of reality. Even in the face of the fact that it doesn't work. Tax handouts for the very wealthy didn't work. And yet, the Republicans were willing to crash our economy to ensure that those tax handouts were sacred. Does that make a lot of sense to you? Because it doesn't make much sense to me. And I look at this legislation that's been put forth by our radicals here in Pennsylvania, who the head of it is telling you, you know, the only way we're going to be able to steal pensions and privatize and destroy education is to steal workers' rights. It's that simple. And the reason that I bring that up again is because that has to be crushed. 6.6% of the workforce is unionized. And yet they're spending all of this time, all of this money and all this energy on destroying what's left of it. And you go, well, why? And the answer is because that's the last voice. That's the last opposition. That's the last roadblock in the road towards complete and total domination. Think about that for a second. Why would they spend so much money? Why so much energy? Why so much effort? Why? Because it's that last roadblock. Once they can destroy that, once they can get rid of the ability of people to come together, well, they've got you, don't they? And I was happy to hear, you know, as Dave Johnson pointed out, that there's organizing going on. We see it every day. Our media doesn't really cover it as well as I think they should, but we're seeing things, whether it's New York or Chicago or Bentonville, Arkansas. We're seeing people taken to the streets, and what's going to happen? We're going to need more of it. You know, when I go to Washington, I like to go to the FDR Memorial because there's a display there of people waiting, standing in line, whether it's the unemployment line or the bread line. But those are people coming together, something common. They held something in common. Look at how masterfully they've destroyed that. I mean, really, stop and think about it. Where do you see people coming together? Our whole society is about dividing us. And they've built it that way. Why do you think they don't want public transportation? They don't want people riding on the bus together talking to each other. They don't want you on the train talking to each other. They want us on that treadmill. They want us running after the cheese, if you will. Something seriously wrong. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, interesting story came across my desk today. How many people remember Russell Erchslaven? No, you probably not. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, was a place kicker in the NFL, played, I think, for the Lions, played for the New Orleans, the Aints back then. Well, he had done a little time for securities and fraud, securities fraud a couple years back. Now arrested today on new charges, running an illegal Ponzi scheme that netted a whopping $2 million. And he's going to go to jail. Guarantee he will spend more time in jail, just like he did the last time, faces up to 20 years in prison for each of the wire and security fraud charges and up to 10 for the money laundering charge. $2 million. What about those criminals that took billions? And if you saw the Frontline piece the other day, the Untouchables, why is it none of those people have gone? Why haven't they gone to jail? Anyway, to find out what's going on in D.C. and around the globe, we've got Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, what's on your mind?
Well, we've got a lot of interesting things in Washington. Nobody's going to jail today, but somebody will go.
I hope so.
In the next couple of years. But the what happened today was a hearing with Senator Kerry. Now, it was an actual, appropriate love fest. Senator Kerry has no downsides. But there was a situation where he was grilled on Chuck Hagel, who is the Republican that was a former senator nominee by the president for the Defense Department. So it's kind of interesting, one senator, Democratic, defending the Republican appointee of a Democrat president.
Yeah, that whole situation just blows my mind. But, I'm sure that the Republicans and the Senate are happy to get rid of Kerry.
Well, I think most likely they would be. Now, they were not so cordial, the Republicans, to their former colleague, Senator Clinton. And just on the inside of it, Rick, I just got to say that, John McCain, of course, I think he thought that John Foster Dulles was up for nomination or something, from the previous president 40 years ago.
Yeah.
because he sure didn't know where he was at in the room. He pontificated, asked the Secretary of State, Clinton, about 10 questions. She had time to answer just very few of it. There was no rhyme or reason. It was a dog and pony show. At the end of the day, Senator Johnson, who, you know, really, quote, gave it to Hillary Clinton, of course, apologized today in a way. He backstepped, backtracked, didn't mean to accuse her of using emotion and on and on. So, you know, the women in combat rule passed in the by Leon Panetta actually was Hillary Clinton in combat yesterday, and she won the war.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and to me, in looking at the reports that I saw, it kind of scares me at how uninformed and how accusatory and how just really partisan this was. I mean, I give Hillary credit. You know, she got up there and showed us that she's got a set.
And they could have, you know, they definitely could have went down a line of questioning to get to the issue, to solve the problem of information coming into the State Department, how it's handled. And they didn't take that approach. They took another approach. So it was really turned out to be not so good of a hearing.
Well, did you really think it was going to be about how to solve the problems? I saw the hearing more as an opportunity to take political shots and to be more divisive.
Well, as a former congressman and having been on investigatory hearings, Congress is the worst at it, historically have been the worst at it. But I thought at least on this one, I really honestly thought they could go down some lines of questioning that would at least have the appearance that they really wanted to find out how information flows in and how they can correct not getting the information to the top of the food chain, meaning the Secretary of State,
right,
and maybe look into why embassies aren't as secure, and that boils down to money, but they just were the worst bunch of questioners I've really seen in about a decade.
Now, I mean, what worries me is that it was more political than how do we fix this and how do we keep those people safe in all of the other embassies that we have across the globe.
Well, you know, they haven't woke up yet. The American people seriously are getting tired of, you know, of people in both parties that are going to go on partisan natures without any resolve to get at the issues. I think that people, you know, are tired of it. Today also, the gun issue was introduced by Senator Feinstein. It's the same assault weapon ban that we have from 1994 to 2004, nothing different on that, except actually it's a little bit more lenient on certain classifications that would be exempt for hunting guns. But there's the 10-clip, you know, change in ammunition. Right now, there might be a few problems for Senator Feinstein in the Senate with not only the Republican side, but a few conservative Democrats on this issue, including Senator Manchin is one of them from, you know, West Virginia, and the senator from Alaska, Begich. So there's a couple of problems there on this issue yet.
That usually is how it is. You know, using the gun analogy, they usually circle the wagons and shoot themselves inward.
Correct.
Not much surprise there. So I'm not surprised. Interesting though, I saw this the nomination of this Mary Jo White, and I brought up the Russell Erxleben thing at the beginning because, you know, here's a guy, you know, $2 million is in the grand scheme of things not an awful lot when you're talking about Ponzi schemes. Probably going to do a good 10-20 years in prison. The people who backed up the trucks and basically heisted the entire economy and, you know, the reason we've had this for the last several years, you know, have walked away scot-free.
Yes, and Mary Jo White is a tough prosecutor. It's a signal, I think, to Wall Street. Of course, the Congress needs to react of not just doing bailouts where, you know, these big banks didn't even have to have transparency at the time. And I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes show last year, but members of Congress were going having a good old time with stocks,
yeah,
and basically flaunting the system of insider information. So I would say not only Wall Street, but the, you know, members and everybody else under the sun had better be aware that Mary Jo White has taken on the syndicate and a lot of tough people, tougher than Wall Street.
Yeah, but, you know, but looking at the congressional offices, that was never really that was never insider trading, so it was never illegal. It was never illegal. It was more immoral, but not illegal,
well,
right?
Yeah. Well, that's true, but, you know, at some point in time, people knew what was going on, and nobody within the system, it technically wasn't illegal for the members, that is. I think other people applying the same principles of knowledge within and buying stocks outside of Congress might have had some problems. But somebody within the system at some point in time should have said, hey, this just... can't pass the smell test.
Yeah.
And nobody did that.
Yeah, I mean, don't watch the stuff. So the question is, you know, how does she get through the nomination the process?
Well, you know, I think that Richard Cordray, by the way, because his name was mentioned in conjunction with hers, because he's going to be renominated to be director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and Richard Cordray had some problems when the president had nominated him a previous position.
Right.
But I think he's got two people out there, and I just can't imagine they can pick both of them apart. Cordray may have a few more problems in the nomination process, but I don't know how they can criticize, you know, Mary Jo White for, you know, being tough on organized crime. I think they'll have a problem if they do.
Yeah, because I think she should go after organized crime. There's a lot of organization there on Wall Street. Go after those criminals. The question then becomes is, will she be allowed to?
I don't know. You know, it will depend on the, you know.
Because I saw this, and I'm going, you know, is this just window dressing, or will she be will she be allowed to go after them like a rabid dog?
I think she's her own person. I think she's shown that. Strange things happen when people get nominated, but I think at this point in time, at least she's her own person.
Yeah. I saw Reid and McConnell, and everyone came up with this filibuster agreement. What are your thoughts on this?
You know, when I was in the House, we used to say that the president is the opponent and the Senate is the enemy. And the Senate is just such a good old boy club. Look, I'm smirking at this because you have Reid and McConnell, and they've got a quote kind of deal, depending on if they're mad at each other or not for that present day. They have a deal of sorts. They really didn't change much, frankly, in the system whatsoever. And one party goes out of control and it wants to make a change, then it comes back in control and it doesn't. I mean, this goes back and forth like a yo-yo for probably 40 years in the Senate.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not much of a change.
I mean, at some point, either you do away with the damn thing or you figure out how you make it to where it works, to where the minority can slow things down, but not clog up the entire system so nothing gets done.
And closure is just a bad idea where you need not a majority of votes to bring legislation up. Whoever created that one had to be, you know, looked at.
I'm sure it was the minority when the Republicans were the minority and
yes,
the Democrats
you're right.
caved on it.
You're actually right. You are correct. I'm thinking back historically because we talked about this years back. It was the Republicans were in the minority. And like I said originally, the Senate's just kind of always been a good old boy club. They'll fight each other, but there are certain things like hideaways and their rooms and their offices and filibusters that they'll come to some agreements on those things pretty quick.
Yeah, I saw that finally the debt ceiling. What do you think of this 3-month deal?
Well, John Boehner didn't even have a press conference, the Republican Speaker of the House. He didn't even have a press conference. He didn't even want to be able to try to defend the thing. The White House said, oh, they've changed their strategy, but, you know, they kind of had to say that. They'll go along with it. It's a temporary fix. Just, you know, nobody pressured Boehner about this temporary measure.
Is Obama trying to annihilate the Republican Party, like John Boehner says? Because, you know, when I saw that, I said, well, I think you're doing a pretty good job of it yourself.
I was just going to say, and, you know, I was a Republican congressman. There's some really good ones out there, and there's some leadership out there that just, you know, tries to look around, and they're not driving the bus, if you like the Speaker of the House. If you're going to be in leadership, you can't look back at the passengers when you're driving the bus. You're bound to wreck.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think they're doing a good job. Maybe Obama's helping them ice the cake, but they baked the cake.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Bob, it's always great talking with you.
Thank you, sir.
The time. Bye-bye. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Earth, sky.
Today, the world's deepest lake.
Russia's Lake Baikal. The water's average depth is more than 700 meters, almost half a mile. In some places, Lake Baikal is more than twice as deep as that.
Lake Baikal is also the oldest lake in the world. It began forming when a fissure in the Eurasian continent opened more than 25 million years ago.
If you exclude polar ice caps and glaciers, Lake Baikal holds over one-fifth of all surface fresh water on Earth. Unlike other deep lakes, it contains dissolved oxygen right down to the lake floor. That means creatures can thrive at all depths in the lake.
Most of Lake Baikal's 2,000-plus species of plants and animals are found nowhere else in the world. Scientists believe up to 40% of the lake's species haven't been described yet. Species endemic to Lake Baikal have evolved over tens of thousands or millions of years. They occupy ecological niches that were undisturbed until the last few decades.
Now, industrial development, paper mills, mining, agriculture, and general population growth on the lake's shores are putting toxic compounds, fertilizers, and other pollutants into Lake Baikal. Find out how scientists are studying how the lake is changing at earthsky.org. Search for the words Deepest Lake. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Had every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. Got an email during the break from Ron, who says, you know, I believe that the U.S. would be greatly served by following the German model of education. He says, we seem to believe that everyone should go to college and work in the service economy, or I believe we need to reinstitute a vocational education regime. Ron says the majority of machinists are nearing retirement. Also, our skilled craftsmen and technicians are also about to retire. If we want to bring back a manufacturing infrastructure, we need the people to run it. And then he hits on something that I think is spot on. He said the diminishing unionization also bodes ill for our ability to train future workers. And Ron says if the Republicans have their way, we will become Mexico, a small, very wealthy upper class, a small middle class if any, and the vast class of peons. And, you know, one of the things that most people don't realize, and you look at the building trades, who they have incredible apprenticeship programs. And when I was a kid going through high school, I mean it was virtually impossible to get into that. There were that many people vying for those jobs because you knew those were going to be jobs that we weren't outsourcing, we weren't doing away with, that were going to pay a decent wage. You're going to be able to support your family and have some security long term. But what we've done in this country is we've allowed the radical right to tear that apart. And now understand there's some legislation, and I think Stephen Bloom is going to be the guy who's going to roll out the, again, let's see who can work for free legislation. How low can we get them to go? How low can we get the peons to work for? How long can we get the people to work standing outside freezing their behind? How low will they go? And I look at this and I go, you know, this, and it's not competition. It's who's willing to slit their neighbor's throat kind of competition. And it's something I don't think we should really, as a society, be encouraging. But I appreciate the email, Ron. And, of course, you can always email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Again, you look at this. I love this rhetoric by the right. Mississippi Governor Phil Bryant, in the same meme as George Bush saying, well, you just go to the emergency room. You don't need health insurance. There are no uninsured. Did you go to the emergency? And the same thing with Mitt Romney. Remember during the campaign, we're not going to let people just die of a heart attack in their apartment. You know, we're going to go get an ambulance and we'll take them to the hospital, right? Remember that? Now you've got the good governor of Mississippi there saying there is no one who doesn't have health care in America. No one, he said. He said, now they may end up going to the emergency room. There are better ways to deal with people that need health care than a massive new program. Which is a nice way of being dismissive of the Affordable Care Act. See, we don't really need it. You know, those 50 million people who don't have health insurance, they could just go to the emergency room. The 200,000 people in Mississippi who extending health care coverage to by expanding the Medicaid program, they don't really need it. They can just go to the emergency room. And to me, part of me goes, the reason our costs are so high, the reason we pay twice as much for health care as everyone else in the industrialized world is because we do dumb things like getting people to use the most expensive modes of health care. I saw this story from the city paper in Philadelphia. They're talking about school nurses and how there's this massive shortage of school nurses and how the budget's just not there and the cuts because of the governor have created this situation. And they tell a couple of stories of, like one kid who had an asthma attack. And because there was no school nurse there, because the school nurse splits time between a couple of schools, she just happened to be there. She wasn't there that day. And the secretary, in the office, obviously, doesn't know how to administer the kid's asthma pump. So what do? They call the ambulance. The ambulance comes, takes the kid to the emergency room. Bang, you're talking a couple thousand dollars just like that. Something that a school nurse would have done and put the kid back in the classroom. Now you've got all that disruption, you've got all of that chaos, and of course you've got all of that cost. And you stop and think about it. The school district in 2011 cut 101 school nurses. According to the city paper, as of this school year, only 84 of the 363 district schools had a full-time nurse. The other almost 280, they shared 103. I mean, just do the math. The city has a student-to-nurse ratio somewhere in the 1,500-to-1. And you wonder, just little things like that run up our health care costs. Little things like this idiot going, well, you just go to the emergency room. The most expensive mode of delivering health care. We don't need any thought. Let the invisible hand do it. And, the other reason, I got to be honest, another reason why I think we have such high health care costs, bubblegum flavored apples. It just blows my mind. Bubblegum flavored apples, all natural. 100% natural. I've said this a couple of times, and I just can't get it out of my head. Same calories as a regular apple, according to their website. Free of soy, free of nuts, free of dairy, free of gluten, non-GMO. These are actual apples, 100% natural, bubblegum flavored apples. Did they come from a bubblegum tree? And I've got to find something about this because it just blows my mind that this is what we've created. Bubblegum apples. If we can grow an apple that tastes like bubblegum, if we can grow an apple that tastes like a grape, if we could, If we can grow an apple on a tree that tastes like a tropical blast, whatever the hell that is, I would think that there's nothing we can't do. We should be able to have full employment within the week. Bubblegum apples. Amazing. I saw this report by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they're saying that the use of high fructose corn syrup, or what they like to be called corn sugar, has actually gone down. And the reason they're saying is the reality is that the cost of corn has tripled since 2004, which is making it a lot more expensive. And one of the things is, you know, they're looking at this and they're going, well, you know, we've got this huge obesity problem in the nation, and does this have something to do with it? What they're saying is the data that they have has shown this steady decline in the high fructose corn syrup or the corn sugar in its popularity. As people consume somewhere in the range of 131 calories of this high fructose corn syrup every day in 2011, which was a 16% drop from just 4 years earlier. What they're saying is the consumption points, soft drinks. That's the main vehicle of consuming this corn sugar or high fructose corn syrup. But that has dropped, and they're saying that the reason they think that the drop of it has happened because soda consumption has dropped 21% from 1998 to 2011. There have been studies cited that that link high fructose corn syrup or corn sugar. Gotta love the change in name, because that's what they do when something gets some stink on it. Just change the name. Something nicer, something softer, something a little more Orwellian, little corn sugar. Who could be against corn sugar? But they're saying that these studies show that this high fructose corn syrup linked to type 2 diabetes and obesity, and a number of cities across the country are going after it. And for me, I go back to what we eat, and I'm not going to go after bubblegum flavored apples until I know exactly what they are. But I got to be honest. There's part of me that goes, I don't get it. Bubblegum flavored apples, how can they be 100% natural? But I'm told that they are. So in the coming days, we're going to get the nutrition facts of the crazy apple that tastes like bubblegum. And if it does, I have to get one of these. I told my wife, put it on the shopping list. I have to have a bubblegum. I don't even like bubblegum, but I have to have an apple that tastes like bubblegum. It's insane, isn't it? And lastly, there's a man in Oregon. And you see a lot of people standing on the street corner asking for things, help, we'll work for food, give me some money, whatever. This guy needs a kidney. So he's out there with a big sign saying, need kidney donor. Turns out he has a rare kind of genetic kidney disorder that he's been undergoing dialysis for the past year and a half. There's nobody in the family that matches it because of this type of disease he's got. And the disease is something of a hereditary nature. So it's impossible for the family to provide it. So he's out on the street corner. Here's a guy who's got health care. He's going, look, I got money. Money's not the problem. Got health insurance. Insurance will pay for everything. It's just been on this list for so long. So he's taken to the streets. Which is one of those reasons why I'm an organ donor. Once I'm gone, if you can find something that works, God bless you. But I look at this Rutgers Law Review article. Only 30,000 transplants performed every year. Because we don't have enough. Anyway, we'll see you back here tomorrow. Have a good night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick.
Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.